won't lie. As long as I see no wrong, I won't need to testify.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, March 27, 2017. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening over another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-475-3250, and our participant code is 449389. You can also find that information on our website underneath the weekly call on the top left side. if anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support National Liberty Alliance's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on our top right. And I did send out an email recently. You know, I've been kind of taking out of my own pocket about $1,000 a month trying to keep things afloat here. I'm considering shutting down the fax machines in order to try to make ends meet here, but if everyone would send in $5 or more, maybe we can meet that $1,000 deficit that we have. We just got to pick things up here. Anyway, whatever people can do is appreciated. Okay, tonight's scripture reading is going to be in Matthew, also in the Sermon on the Mount, chapter 5. We're going to read verses 38 through 48. So Matthew chapter 5, verses 38 through 48. You have heard that it has been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you that ye resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if any man will sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain or two. Give to him that asketh thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not thou away. Ye have heard that it hath been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thy enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that ye may be the children of your Father, which is in heaven. For he maketh the sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust. For if ye love them which love you, what reward have ye? Do not even the publicans the same? And if ye salute your brethren only, what do ye more than others? Do not even the publicans so? Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father, which is in heaven, is perfect. Matthew chapter 5, that was on the Sermon on the Mount, and that was verses 38 through 48. Okay, let's see. Tonight, we did send out an email concerning administrators, people who want to be administrators. They need to become active. We've got a lot of administrators. We've got about 1,000 administrators out there, people who are interested in taking on that position on the county level, which will be a paid position. For administering to the grand jurist and the trial jurist. They would be the investigative body. It's a really good job. It's a good position to be in. We certainly don't need people who are going to be vengeful and getting in there to take it even or anything and be vengeful. We do need people who are going to be honorable, merciful. A sense of honor, justice, and mercy is what we teach everyone. And that's how we have to come. We're not out here to go after people. We're out here to take our nation back. I don't know if anybody's been listening to what has been going on the reports up there. We've been putting them up on our website under the news. Okay, let me see if I can find this real quickly. Oh, I don't have the page open. Okay, well, anyway, on our news page, if you highlight the news, you'll find the press conferences that are every couple of days. They don't actually happen every day, sometimes three times a week, sometimes four times a week. It's called the White House briefing. And today's White House briefing was very, very interesting. I almost felt like Trump had read our paper concerning nullification. Although they didn't use the word nullification, they used other words. And we had the Attorney General coming out there talking about the law, you know, and how the state's got to obey it, and the president has a duty to protect the nation, and he can't be putting up with this garbage. I'm paraphrasing. People need to go out and actually hear what this man has actually said. And so clearly something is happening. The president is starting to take a new direction here. And I think he's ready for nullification. I hope he is. And again, I know that, he should have gotten it by now. Of course, there is a bureaucracy of paperwork, but I don't know. Maybe however that works, but I think he's gotten it. And clearly today's White House briefing, I had the impression that I think he got our paper and he responded to it. So let's hope that that is the case. Either way, he's heading down the road we're heading anyway, and we need to work with him on this, and we do need his support. We got other papers going out. We got two papers today we wrote, extremely important, and these are the last two papers that I need to have had gotten written in order to now go to approach the Attorney General. One of them is on standing, and the other one is on law itself. What is the law? You know, so I've got, it's called the Memorandum of Law in Support of the Law. I might change that name, but right now that's what it is. The other memorandum is called the Memorandum of Law in Support of Standing. Now, they're both relatively short. One's only 4 pages long, and the other one's 9 pages, and we've got a lot of footnotes, so it's a lot shorter than that. There's a chart in the law one, which I'm not going to read tonight, the chart, but I am going to read through the law one, and that takes up a couple of pages, that chart, and so it's not that long is my point. I have not had this perfected yet. This is the first time I'm reading it out loud, you know, so it may be a little rough. It has not been posted yet. I'll post it as soon as we get it perfected. Tonight's reading will help to tell me whether, you know, how much fixing we got to do on it yet. But I don't want to hold it back because I think it's such an important subject, and I really want to get forward on it. Those people who are becoming administrators, they need to know these things. They need to be understanding about what the law really is and what a statute is. And if they don't know the difference and they can't articulate the difference, or at least understand the difference, you know, look, out of 4 people in every county, one person should be able to speak. Maybe others can't speak as well as one could do maybe better writing or whatever their skill sets may be. And but between the four of them, they should be able to do what they have to do. And they can also work with the administrators in the counties next door. And we'll work our way through. We'll fumble our way through. I do that in everything in life I do. I fumble my way through things, and eventually you get pretty good, decent at it, and you can do what you got to do. But if you don't do it, you're not going to learn how to do it. But we're expecting administrators to be involved. We're expecting them to put in some time, at least 1 hour a week, in time. They need to get some experience talking to people or working with a committee or organizing or something, okay? And so if you are an administrator and you're not doing anything at this point, call Jan. You can find him under the directory on our website, nationallibertyalliance.org, highlight directory, click on directory, that is, and call Jan and tell him, give him your information, tell him who you are, you're an administrator, and anybody could do this. You don't have to be a person that's an administrator. Everybody should be doing this. Everybody should be putting an hour a week or more into what we're doing here. We need to work together. We need to organize, and we need to move forward. We need to prepare. We're going to have a lot of people that are going to find out about us very quickly once the explosion goes through, so to speak. You know, we're looking for that landslide, critical mass. And when that happens, a lot of people are going to be coming in, but we're going to get a lot of angry people who have not been hearing our message and responding and thinking about our message and realizing that we're not going to get anywhere with anger and hate. We're only going to get somewhere with honor, justice, and mercy. And so we have to teach these people. And these people will try to take positions, and they will get them, probably. And they may cause more problems than what we really want. So that's why we have to prepare and be ready to receive these people and train them in a way that they need to understand. The attitude is the most important thing. And I think that's key. Look, at just understanding honor, justice, and mercy and believing in those things, taking that oath, that's how you're going to operate in your job. And then everything else is on the job training. But right now is on the job training. Right now, people should be doing the constitutional course. Right now, every administrator should be doing the civics course. Right now, every administrator, and everyone else too, of course, but we have 1,000 people there. We got 6,000 people now. I think we're 6 or 7 shy of 6,000 people right now as we speak. So we got 6,000 people, and of that, 1/6 of those people have chosen to become grand jury administrators, which they that becomes the investigative body. We're going to have a special course coming up soon, which will be on just for administrators. But right now we have those other two courses. They need to get through them. We have all the papers we've written. People need to read. They need to know how to write. Read the papers and you'll learn how to write, you know. Anybody wants to be a writer, you read. Good readers become good writers. So that's the game plan there. Monday night meetings is very important to keep up on what's going on, to kind of get the lesson that's in focus for that particular night. Tonight it's going to be on the law, what I perceive as the most important thing that anyone needs to understand today is these two positions. One is on the law and the other is on standing. The question is, standing is so abused these days, it's pretty pathetic that we fall for it. Nobody looks into it, what it really means, what it's really all about. Well, tonight's an opportunity to learn and know what standing is all about. And they can't pull the wool over your eyes no more when they try to tell you you don't have standing. I'd like to see that explained here, Your Honor. You know, what are you talking about? I ain't got standing. Okay, so anyway, you need to know the law and what the law really is, and standing is important too. So we'll start with the law. Memorandum of law in support of the law, okay? And again, the difference between statutes and law. And you have to stand strong on this. This is an extremely important subject matter. I knew I did. We didn't want to talk with the Attorney General until we got this paper done, because we need to hit lock horns with him. He's a lawyer. He's taught by the bar, just like all the other lawyers. And he needs to understand real quick what the difference is between the law and statutes. If we're going to save this nation, we have to stand on the law. Statutes are for them, not us. The law is for us. And let's understand the difference. I know Donald Trump, if he reads this, he'll understand it very quickly because he's not a lawyer. It seems that anybody that's not a lawyer can understand this stuff very easily. People who are lawyers, I'm confused. What are you talking about? I don't know what it is about them. They're that brainwashed, I guess. Well, after all, they spend hundreds of thousands of dollars or $100,000 to get their law license, whatever it is. I have no clue, but, spend a lot of money to go to college. And what did they learn? They didn't learn the law, that's for sure. They learned to become minions for the elite. But now they have to go learn the law. Okay, the law. Memorandum of law in support of the law. Okay, before any court can have the authority to hear a case, and I don't have a copy of this up yet. I apologize. Again, we've been under a lot of pressure trying to get things done. This was just completed today, and it has not been perfected. I want to repeat that again. And so it may be very awkward as we go along. It just needs to go through that process. Maybe in a day or so we'll have both these papers up there, and they'll be put up onto the docket page because they'll be going out into the courts this week. Okay, before any court can have authority to hear a case, they must have both personam and subject matter jurisdiction. Any court, not a court of record, has no authority to proceed without the consent of the persons involved. American courts are vested by we the people, the author and source of law, through constitutions written by we the people. Therefore, they must first have constitutional authority over an individual. Furthermore, all state laws and constitutions are ultimately governed by the Constitution for the United States of America, as ordained by we the people in Article 6, Clause 2, called the Supremacy Clause, that defines the law of the land, which renders anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding, in other words, null and void. And Article 3, Section 1, Common Law Courts, whereas the judge retains his authority only during good behavior. No judicial process whatsoever can have any lawful authority outside of the limits of the jurisdiction of the court or judge by whom it is issued. And an attempt to enforce it beyond these boundaries is nothing less than lawless violence. That which the law requires to be done or forborne to a determinate person or the public at large, correlative to a vested and coextensive right in such a person or the public, and the breach of which constitutes negligence. The law. The definition of law is that which is laid down, ordained, or established. It is a rule or method according to which phenomena or actions coexist or follow each other and must be obeyed or be subject to sanctions or legal consequences. In our republic, common law is the law of the land by which we the people choose to be judged. When we assumed among the powers of the earth the separate and equal stations to which the laws of nature and nature's God entitled them, further declaring, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Obedience to the Constitution is the extent of that consent. With reference to its origin, law is derived either from 1, judicial precedents, from 2, legislation, or 3, from custom. Black's Law Dictionary, 4th edition, compiles and defines a complete collection of terms and phrases of American and English jurisprudence, ancient and modern, listing 51 different categories of law. They are categorized under the aforesaid three derivatives as followed. Now, let me see if I'm going to read this part. Okay, yeah, these two quotes, I should probably, it's coming in kind of tiny, we'll probably enlarge in this and make it part of it. So let me read this. Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction both as to the law and facts. In all cases in equity, thereby becoming the final arbiter and maker of the case law governed by American jurisprudence under the rules of common law. The Supreme Court has no appellate authority over cases in law, also known as jury trials, which with the one exception of protecting individuals if an unalienable right of the same is violated. That's very important to understand that. The United States Supreme Court does not have appellate authority over a jury trial. Think about that. How many people really know that? I would imagine quite a few people that are with National Liberty Alliance here knows that, but most people don't understand or know that. That's very important to understand. They cannot second judge us. And so when you get a judge that hears a case and second guesses the jury and decides to say, I want to throw this case out, they can't do that. They can't. The United States Supreme Court can't second guess a jury trial. How can some silly judge who's really not even a judge at all at this point in time, he's only the administrator of the court acting as a magistrate, even though he has the name judge next to him, that doesn't amount to a hill of beans ultimately as far as law is concerned. He has no say in this. Those 12 individuals who have decided the fate of the individual on trial, those are the people that make the decision. That's the tribunal. They are the judges. They are the arbiters. They are the ones that decide what's going to happen and not going to happen. No appellate authority over cases in law, also known as jury trials, with the one exception of protecting an individual if an unalienable right of the same is violated. Federal district court judges, when hearing a case in equity, are governed by American jurisprudence and case law. Excuse me. Under the rules of common law, in cases in law, judges or magistrates take on an administrative role with no summary judgment powers, whereas the jury, also known as the tribunal of 12 people, is the final arbiter, deciding the facts, law, and remedy with the power of nullification and mercy. This is called a court of record, from which there is no appeal. The decision of a superior court, and this is a court case, Ex Parte Watkins, 3rd Peter, quoted in quite a few court cases, the decision of a superior court may only be challenged in a court of appeal. The decision of an inferior court is subject to collateral attack. In other words, in a superior court, one may sue an inferior court directly rather than resorting to an appeal to an appellate court. In other words, we go to court, and the judge does something stupid, we go directly after the judge. We don't go to appeal it to nobody. We don't go and ask someone to please rehear the case or reset something. No, we go and deal with it ourselves. We give them a writ of error, we overrule them, and we make them part of the conspiracy if it's necessary. He becomes now one of the defendants, and we move on. That's how a court case goes in a court of record. In any event, it is all binding on all of the decisions of the court of record may not be appealed. It is binding in all other courts. However, no statutory or constitutional court, whether it be an appellate or a Supreme Court, can second-guess the judgments of a court of record. The judgment of a court of record, that's a trial by jury, where the tribunal, the 12 people, make the decision. The judgment of a court of record, whose jurisdiction is final, is as conclusive on all the world as the judgment of this court would be. It is as conclusive on the on this court as it is on other courts. It puts an end to inquiry concerning the facts by deciding it. And again, that's Ex Parte Watkins, 3 Peter. Okay, now at this point on the paper, I've listed all of the different laws that I have found in Black's Law. And I believe there's 53 of them, something like that. I think I had a number here. well, whatever it is, it's written in here somewhere. So I think there's 53 of them. You know, there's case law, there's equity law, unwritten law, civil law, probate law, mercantile law, bankruptcy law, administrative law, admiralty law, arms law, commercial law, penal law, prospective law, maritime law. I mean, it goes on and on and on. Public law, revenue law, statutory law, Ecclesiastes, foreign, special law. and it goes on and on and on and on. But our Constitution has been very clear on what the law is. The constitutional law, Article 3, establishes common law, equity law, admiralty law, and maritime law. Admiralty law and maritime law is law at sea, whereas common law and equity law is the law of the land. Common law and equity law ultimately is the same. The two big differences, if you're under the common law procedure, they both run under the rules of common law anyway. But you know, the common law is looking at a jury, which is a court of record, which cannot be second guessed. Equity law ultimately, best way to look at that is contract law. If you have a contract with someone, a dispute with someone, you'd go to a judge and let the judge decide. If it's over $20, the Constitution, through the Bill of Rights, I believe it is, says that you have the right to a trial by jury. You can turn it over into a tribunal and let the people decide. Anything over $20, that's your unalienable right to do that. In most cases, we would let the judge do it as long as we have justice in the courts. Right now, we don't have justice in the courts. I wouldn't let a judge decide anything at all, for me anyway. I'd want a jury trial for everything. But, you know, if they were if they were just and doing the right things, I'd let them make the decision because you figured they'd pick up on it and do the right thing. Now, there's an appellate system to that. You know, you can appeal it to the Court of Appeals or the appellate process, and you know, if you don't like the decision of the judge that made the ruling, and that's the process, and that's called equity. But under the common law, you know, in a court of record, you know, you're now in a situation where the jury makes a decision, and it is final. End of the day, and those are the two courts that these Article 3 courts are to be. They can also hear admiralty law, and they can hear maritime law, but that identifies with things going on at sea. It has nothing to do with we the people on the land. There is also bankruptcy courts and probate courts. There's a couple of, you know, there's a few other courts. Those are two of the few other courts that are permitted. But again, ultimately, those are administrative courts. You can't be forced into them. Nobody has the right or the authority to come and to, you know, force you into those courts if you don't want to be in those courts. They're administrative courts, so you have to agree to them. Now, I know there are probate situations going on. There are situations where people have lost control of their parents because they had a, you know, maybe they've got a lot of money And the courts get their claws in on that, and they put a trustee in charge, and next thing you know, you have no control over your parents, and you got some stranger taking care of your parents, just making decisions for them, and the children can no longer make those decisions. That's a horror that takes place every day across this nation, and it's a moneymaker for them. And it's all illegal, okay? Nevertheless, if you wanted to challenge those courts, you would find they have no proof of claim, and they have no fiduciary authority, because who can give it to them? You know, it is true that the judge will try to give them the fiduciary authority. He'll appoint the judgee, but appointing the judgee without the claim, it doesn't work. It's worthless. It's irrelevant. It doesn't hold up in a court of law. Of course, they do it all day long. People don't know about it, and they just get suckered into the game. Lawyers don't know about it, it seems, because they never do anything, or maybe they're warned away from doing anything, and you lose control of your family. This happens in family court, too, by the way. Equity and justice are substantively equivalent terms, if not synonymous. Under constitutional provision guaranteeing rights to obtain justice, the justice to be administered by courts is not an abstract justice as conceived of by the judge, but justice according to the law, or as it is phrased in the Constitution, conformably to the laws. The law of nature, juris naturali, is natural law, lex naturali. It is absolute law, the true and proper law of nature, also known as common law, as distinguished from the law created by the enactment of legislators. Common law is the use of legal principles to discover by the light of nature or abstract reasoning comprised of the body of those principles and rules of action relating to the government and security of persons and property, which derive their authority solely from usage and customs of ancient antiquity. Equity law, it is the system of jurisprudence administered by the purely secular tribunals in equity courts, in other words, contracts. Judges are to act under American jurisprudence, which is the philosophy of law, the knowledge of things divine and human, the science of what is right and what is wrong, the constant and perpetual disposition to render every man his due. It has no direct concern with questions of moral or political policy, but they fall under the providence of ethics and legislation. They are to mete out justice, which is the most extensive sense of the word, and it differs very little from virtue, for it includes within itself the whole circle of virtue. Justice, being itself a part of virtue, is confined to things simply good or evil, and consist in man's taking such a proportion of them as he ought. The author of law. God is the author of common law, which he wrote in the hearts of men, thereby giving we the people both the knowledge of right and wrong and unalienable right of we the people to judge each other through tribunals called juries. We the people ordained common law in Amendment 7. And Congress clearly followed suit and established it through 28 U.S.C. subsection 132. We, the sovereign people, ordained and established the Constitution, which is the law of the land, to be obeyed by all elected and appointed and hired servants. We, the people, vested Congress with certain law-making powers in Article 1, Section 8, among which we gave no legislative powers to write ordinances, regulations, codes, or statutes that would control the behavior of we the people or apply any set punishment upon we the people. That authority belongs to the people, of course, through juries. The very meaning, and this is, this is quite a few quotes put together. The very meaning of sovereignty is that the decree of the sovereign makes the law. A consequence of this prerogative is the legal ubiquity of the king, nature's God, His majesty in the eye of the law is always present in all his courts. Though he cannot personally distribute justice, his judges, that's the juries, we the people, his judges are the mirror by which the king's image is reflected. We come with that sense of honor, that sense of justice, that sense of mercy, to do the right thing, to mete out justice, to make sure restitution takes place. Unalienable rights come from nature's God and are not subject to alienation. The characteristic of those things which cannot be bought or sold or transferred from one person to another, such as certain personal rights. Example, liberty, inalienable, incapable of being alienated. That is sold and transferred. Cannot be sold or transferred. Rights are defined generally as powers of free action, not subject to legal constraint of another being unconstrained, having power to follow the dictates of one's own will, not subject to the dominion of another, not compelled to involuntary servitude. Any statute that violates rights is null and void. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Statutes, codes, and regulations. Now, this is the key. You know, what we just read here is so extremely important that we need to understand that we are responsible for our own actions. They don't get to decide for us. If we have to be judged, we are to be judged by our peers, not by elected officials, not by the servant. The servant of the house does not get to judge we the people. They're the servant. We're the master. Servants don't judge masters. The people can judge the people. And they have to do it through the eyes of the king. And that's nature's God. Honor, justice, and mercy. Seeking out justice. Statutes, codes, and regulations. We need to understand what they are. Okay, Congress was empowered under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18 to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing 17 powers and all other powers vested in this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department office thereof. Under our system of government, upon the individuality and intelligence of the citizen, the state does not claim to control him or her, except to his or her conduct to others, leaving him or her the sole judge as to all that affects himself or herself. There, every person is independent of all laws except those prescribed by nature. He is not bound by any institution formed by his fellow man without his consent. Statutes that violate the plain and obvious principles of common right and common reason are null and void. The assertion of federal rights, when plainly and reasonably made, is not to be defeated under the name of local practice. A state may not impose a charge for the enjoyment of a right granted by the federal constitution. The state cannot diminish rights of the people. The claim and exercise of a constitutional right cannot be converted into a crime. If the state converts a liberty into a privilege, the citizen can engage in that right with impunity. Laws are made for us. We were not made for the laws. As a matter of fact, that's a direct biblical quote that's been quoted in that particular case that comes out of Black's Law. Well, there's quite a few cases that quote that particular part. But the laws are not made for us. Laws are made for us. We are not made for the laws. Statutes are legislated law. But when a statute is passed in violation of law, that is, of the fundamental law or constitution of a state, it is the prerogative of the courts to declare it void, or in other words, to declare it not to be law. Therefore, an unconstitutional statute is not law. The phrase at law is used to point out that thing which is done according to the course of the common law. It is distinguished from a proceeding in equity. All codes, rules, regulations are for government authorities only, not human creators in accordance with God's laws. All codes, rules, and regulations are unconstitutional and lacking due process. All laws, rules, and practices which are repugnant to the Constitution are null and void. The common law is the real law, the supreme law of the land. The codes, the rules, the regulations, the policies, the statutes, they are not the law. The general rule is that an unconstitutional statute, though having the form and name of law, is in reality no law, but is wholly void and ineffective for any purpose since its unconstitutionality dates from the time of its enactment. In legal contemplation, it is as inoperative as if it had never been passed. Since an unconstitutional law is void, the general principle follows that it imposes no duties, it confers no rights, it creates no office, it bestows no power or authority on anyone. It affords no protection and justifies no acts performed under it. A void act cannot be legally consistent with a valid one. An unconstitutional law cannot operate to supersede any existing law. Indeed, insofar as a statute runs counter to the fundamental law of the land, which is the Constitution, it is superseded thereby. And remember, when we go back to the Constitution, you know, the Constitution itself, you know, is all about the control of our government until it gets to the Bill of Rights. Now, the Bill of Rights, it's still about the control of the government. It's a bill of prohibitions. You can't do this, you can't do that, you can't do the other thing. You shall not make any law concerning this. You can't make any laws concerning that. But it does identify some of the main, most important rights that we have. You know, the right of free speech, the right of religious choice, the right of to be able to protect ourselves, to have a weapon, the right of the militia, the right of due process. All these things protect us. And those are important laws. And every law is judged by the Bill of Rights. Whenever you look at a law, you look at the Bill of Rights. If it's in violation to the Bill of Rights, it's null and void. End of subject. Okay? If they want to make you have a permit to have a weapon, obviously the Bill of Rights says no, you can't make that happen. And that's the case that we have going here in New York, amongst many other cases. Let's see. A void act cannot be legally consistent with a valid one. An unconstitutional law cannot operate to supersede any existing law. Indeed, insofar as a statute runs counter to the fundamental law of the land, the Constitution, it is superseded thereby. No one is bound to obey an unconstitutional law, and no courts are bound to enforce it. The act of regulating a rule or order prescribed for management or government, a regulating principle. It's a precept, rule of order prescribed by a superior or competent authority relating to the action of those under its control. We, the sovereign people, are not under the control of management or control of government agencies. To the contrary, governments are instituted among men deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. We, the people, vested Congress with the authority to write regulations for commerce, military, and government. All federal agency heads obviously have the authority to write regulations in order to manage, and the president can alter these regulations by executive order. Regulations are just, in other words, for policies and procedures, how things work. Conclusion. We, the sovereign people, have unalienable rights under the laws of nature's God, also known as the common law. We, the people, are not bound by statutes, codes, or regulations. Congress has no authority to codify and license our rights, and no court has the authority to enforce such repugnant statutes. Any judge restraining said rights are in bad behavior and will suffer the wrath of the people through indictments and judgments in courts of justice. Now, we're kind of hoping to get this out on March 29th, what is that, Thursday or something? Actually, yeah, it's Wednesday. But, you know, I could see as I read through this tonight, it needs a little more work. I got to clean up a few things, and, of course, we still have to get the punctuation cleaned up. So hopefully it'll be up in a couple of days, and maybe we will get it out on Wednesday. But I think more towards Thursday or Friday. Now, real quickly, this is a short one on standing. It gets a little bit repetitive in one area, but for purposes of making a point, I'm going to be repetitive in that one area. You'll know it when I get to it. It's only a few pages long. It should go pretty quick. And this is about standing. How many people have been thrown out of court because they don't have standing? How many people ever went to look to see what standing really is, and how can you meet what standing is? It's going to blow your mind when you find out how easy it is to get standing and how you can hold that judge's feet to the fire to let him know, excuse me, you can't make that decision. Write down, I want to know how you got to that decision. You show me, okay? In our case, being a grand jury, we're just going to overrule him and bring him in as a defendant because we already know the game he's playing. So, but we'll give him a writ of error, we'll overturn his decision, and we'll move on with another magistrate. We'll let him know. We've already let these people know. They're not judges. Don't think you can make any decisions. There are no decisions to be made by any judge in this court. You're just an administrator of the court. You sign what we tell you to sign, and that's it, period. But here it is, the one on support of standing. In the United States, the current doctrine is that a person cannot bring a suit challenging the constitutionality of a law unless the plaintiff can demonstrate that he is or will imminently be harmed by the law. Otherwise, the court will rule that the plaintiff lacks standing to bring the suit and will dismiss the case without considering the merits of the claim of unconstitutionality. Now, when Robert Schultz brought a case up in New York State Supreme Court, and I forget what case it was in, but they found that he didn't have standing. And in his case, when they made the point to not have standing, they're thinking a little different than we are. They were making the point that he was a slave, and that's why he didn't have standing. Robert Schultz didn't understand that. We explained that to him, but it's, you know, he was taught by lawyers, so he's kind of stuck in that lawyer thing, that mode that's very hard to get out if few lawyers can escape, okay? He was stuck in that, and he just couldn't understand. He thought we were crazy talking like that, but that's exactly why and how they get away with it, okay? But if he would have made his case, then maybe he would have thought a little different because he, too, made that mistake of not going up to look to see what no standing means and to put the feet to the fire, you know, of these judges to show me where is it that we don't have standing because they don't put it to paper. They just say, you don't have standing, goodbye, see you later, another day. Anyway, in the United States, the current doctrine is that a person cannot bring a suit challenging the unconstitutionality of the law unless the plaintiff can demonstrate that he or she will have imminently be harmed by the law. Otherwise, the court will rule that the plaintiff lacks standing to bring a suit and will dismiss the case without considering the merits of the claim of unconstitutionality. Same thing that was found to him when he went up to the, you know, towards the United States Supreme Court. He kept being found that he had no standing for a redress of grievances, which was an unalienable right, and it's also listed in the Bill of Rights, right, redress of grievances. In law, standing, or locus standi, I think you might sound it, L-O-C-U-S, locus, or locus standi, is the term for the ability of a party to demonstrate to the court sufficient connection to and harm from the law or action challenged to support that party's participation in the case. Standing exists from one of three causes. Cause number one, something to lose doctrine. The party is directly subject to an adverse effect by the statute or action in question, and the harm suffered will continue unless the court grants relief in the form of damages or finding that the law either does not apply to the party or that the law is void or can be nullified. This is called the something to lose doctrine, in which the party has standing because they directly will be harmed by the conditions for which they are asked, that they are asking the court for relief. Now, again, you know, every case that we bring in the court is a constitutional case, and everything brings us right back to the Bill of Rights, the Bill of Prohibition, which gives us standing, okay? And so right there, you get standing. Okay, how's a judge going to get around that? They can't. Make them write something on a piece of paper. They need to write how they came to their conclusion, and you need to push that. They can't write how it is unless they just put down because you're a slave. You have no standing. Thank you very much. Goodbye. They're not going to do that, of course. Okay, chilling effect doctrine. This is the second way you can get in to have standing. The party is not directly harmed by the conditions by which they are petitioning the court for the relief, but asks for it because the harm involved has some reasonable relation to their situation, and the continued existence of that harm may affect others who might not be able to ask the court for relief. In the United States, this is the ground for asking for a law to be struck down as violating the First Amendment, because while the plaintiff might not be directly affected, the law might so adversely affect others that one might never know what was not done or created by those who fear they would become subject to the law, the so-called chilling effects doctrine. So if you're chilled by a law, even though you're not directly affected by it, you could have standing. Acts of law, and this is the primary one in my opinion, okay, the party is granted automatic standing by an act of law. Well, you got unalienable rights. That's an act of law. The Bill of Rights is unalienable rights, but it's also an act of law because we the people wrote it and made it law in the Constitution, and therefore it's an act of law, and a violation of any of those laws brings us into the right for the act of law doctrine. In a republic such as ours, the unalienable rights of the one trumps the will of the whole of society. If one or more of the blessings of liberty is in imminent danger of loss by one, they have the unalienable right of due process to secure that right. The defendant in the case before this court threatened the rights of both the one and the whole of society. Let me reread that first part. In a republic such as ours, the unalienable rights of the one trumps the will of the whole society. That is very important. We are a republic. You have an unalienable right. Everybody can hate your guts and say no, and you can get the entire society to disagree with you, but they must find for you in a republic because they cannot take that unalienable right, whatever it might be, away from you. The Declaration of Independence was initiated by 56 people. The Constitution for the United States of America was initiated by 39 people. And this restoration of that Declaration and Constitution is herein initiated by 6,000 grand jurists, also known as the jureties of the peace, on behalf of themselves and on behalf of those unable to articulate their case before the court, and on behalf of the deceived that have been lulled to sleep by the orchestrators of treachery. We are 110 jurists from Alabama, 41 jurists from Alaska, 207 jurists from Arizona, 47 jurists from Arkansas, 581 jurists from California, 171 jurists from Colorado, 110 jurists from Connecticut, 21 jurists from Delaware, 505 jurists from Florida, 172 jurists from Georgia, 57 jurists from Hawaii, 94 jurists from Idaho, 177 jurists from Illinois, 113 jurists from Indiana, 44 jurists from Iowa, 56 jurists from Kansas, 67 jurists from Kentucky, 73 jurists from Louisiana, 50 jurists from Maine, 112 jurists from Maryland, 81 jurists from Massachusetts, 268 jurists from Michigan, 82 jurists from Minnesota, 42 jurists from Mississippi, 150 jurists from Missouri, 68 jurists from Montana, 54 jurists from Nebraska, 75 jurists from Nevada, 56 jurists from New Hampshire, 117 jurists from New Jersey, 61 jurists from New Mexico, 439 jurists from New York, 206 jurists from North Carolina, 27 jurists from North Dakota, 165 jurists from Ohio, 72 jurists from Oklahoma, 147 jurists from Oregon, 306 jurists from Pennsylvania, 24 jurists from Rhode Island, 95 jurists from South Carolina, 41 jurists from South Dakota, 119 jurists from Tennessee, 401 jurists from Texas, 116 jurists from Utah, 24 jurists from Vermont, 120 jurists from Virginia, 273 jurists from Washington, 45 jurists from West Virginia, 107 jurists from Wisconsin, and 56 jurists from Wyoming. Simply said, we are the resolved people of the United States of America, and we are here to take our republic, courts of fiction notwithstanding. In fulfillment of the something to lose doctrine, we, the resolved people, are in jeopardy of losing our unalienable rights to tyrants who refuse to answer. In fulfillment to the chilling effects doctrine, we, the resolved people, are unjustly jailed, denied due process in courts of law, unconstitutionally taxed, tried in jurisdictions unknown, spied upon through our phones, TVs, cars, emails, and cameras everywhere. Our children are stolen. Our parents are robbed of their fruits of their life's labor and enjoyment of their twilight years, and we are robbed of our homes by detestable non-judicial foreclosures, to name just a few. In fulfillment of an act of law, our founding fathers expressed a desire in order to prevent misconduct of abuse of its powers, that further declaratory and restrictive clauses should be added. Thank God for the Bill of Rights. That's what this is talking about. And as extending the grounds of public confidence in the government will best ensure the beneficial ends of its institution and thereby added to the Constitution a bill of prohibitions, being an act of law whereby we, the resolved people, have declared and here today reiterate our standing. Conclusion. We, the sovereign people, have an unalienable right under the laws of nature's God, also known as the common law. We, the people, are not bound by statutes, codes, or regulations. Congress has no authority to codify and license our rights, and no court has the authority to enforce such repugnant statutes. We, the sovereign people, provided for ourselves through the Constitution courts of justice called Article III courts, where we, the people, have standing, whether we are one or a thousand, and any judge robbing the people of that standing and or court of record are in bad behavior and will suffer the wrath of the people through indictments and judgments in a court of record. And then sealed and dated and signed, and that's the end. So these two papers, you know, I see there has a little more work to do. I think we can probably get it done in the next day or two and get it perfected and potentially out by Thursday or Friday, and then we'll post it. We'll announce it again by email when Jan puts out the newsletter. He'll let everyone know it's up there, and we'll probably make note of it next week. Now, our next paper after this is, now we're going up to talk to the Attorney General. We wanted to make a preparation of a certain logic. We wanted to define the law. We wanted to lay out the power and the authority of we, the people, who we are, by what authority we act as jurists, how we came to be, all those things. All those papers are all now written. We've got everything written necessary to define who we are, what we're doing, where we're going, and why we're doing it. And the fact that we have opened up a court of record that is not a civil court. It is a common law court, a court of record. It's going to be ruled by the people, tribunals, and it's going to have a magistrate, which we will accept their judges, whoever they want to put on. We don't care. They just have no power or authority to do anything except for what we tell them to do. We'll tell them what papers to sign, and we'll tell them what papers they can't sign. And we will make them a defendant if they try to give us some trouble. We also are going to ask, and we're going to copy the president on this. We've been copying him on everything we do. So we're going to copy him on this as we send it to this lawful attorney general who is insisting on the law to be obeyed, must be obeyed, has to be obeyed. Go listen to what he said today. Could have thought that we wrote some of the stuff he had to say, as a matter of fact. So people should go out and listen to what he had to say. You can find it on the newspaper page. We told you. Let me go. I'll tell you where it's at again. Underneath news. I like news, White House briefing. Click on White House briefing, and it's, I believe it was today's. If it wasn't today, it was the day before, but I know it was today's. Sure it was. Click on that and watch the one on the top, and you will find the Attorney General coming out talking as if he's us, okay? Well, we're going to hold his words. Matter of fact, we're going to use his words against him, okay? And we're going to tell him that he needs to give us a United States Attorney prosecutor. It's okay if he comes from New York. Whoever the president appointed, we don't care where he comes from. You can send him to us from California, Timbuktu. We don't care. All we want a prosecutor. We want him to come down here because we're ready to do indictments. And we need a prosecutor to make these indictments. And we will watch him like a hawk. Okay? That's our attitude. We have the authority. We have the rights. We have the law. We have everything. We are poised for this point now. There's everything we've been working on and putting together and to try to accomplish is to get to this very point where we are today to move indictments through the court and to chill these people who are the enemies of liberty that is disrupting our liberty, our peace, our tranquility, our right to the tranquility. And it's time for these people to go to jail. Now, I do think the timing is right. We have the perfect guy in the White House for this. We have the guy who says the law is going to be obeyed. We've got to obey the law. Well, okay, the law's got to be obeyed. We got that guy there. We got the president who talks about the law, and he's going to be watching. And we're going to see what he's going to do. And we will go after the president if we have to go after the president to make him to enforce the attorney general to obey the law, enforce the law, and to put these people in jail. After all, the crust of our case, the most important part of the case, is that we are reporting to these people that there are enemies, both foreign and domestic, with inside our government, who are destructive to everything of what America is. They are taking away our children. They take away our parents. They take away our homes. They take away our money. They take away our liberties. They take away everything. You know, I heard about a situation where, you know, we're trying to do something for some people in that's in jail, and they heard about us writing to these people, and now they've restricted them to certain information, restrained them from certain access to law, and these people are in jail. How dare these people do this? Who are these people? These people need to go to jail. They're on the wrong side of the bars. We got to do something about this. And it's time for us, we the people, to step up now. It's time for everybody to get onto the phones. If you're not involved with what we are doing, if you have not got your name with Jan right now on a list somewhere to put in an hour or more a week, shame on you. It's time to get the work done. We need everybody involved. We need everybody's elbow involved here. And if you're an administrator, you need to be going through these courses. Even if you're not an administrator, you need to be educated. If the people expect to be ignorant and free, forget about it. It's not going to happen. So let's get educated. We need to educate our children. We were talking earlier about creating some textbooks for the schools. We put some ideas together. You know, that really might be very good stuff that we can put into the schools rather quickly. It's going to take some time to put it together, but I think we can put about 3 or 4 textbooks together in a couple of weeks easily because of what's out there and available for us as tools to use to create these textbooks. Okay? We've got the 2 courses we got going right now. Again, administrators, if you're not involved, if you're not in there and putting an hour or more and you're not involved doing things and learning and you're not coming to the Monday night meetings and you're not learning, you're not taking the constitutional course and you're not taking the civics course, I will do everything I can in my power to prevent you from becoming an administrator and taking that job. I promise. Because it's wrong for anyone who has the time to get educated, who has chosen to take on that job, which is a paid position, I'll repeat it again, a professional paid position with a handsome salary. And if you think you're going to put your name on a list and take on that job, I am going to do everything I can to prevent that from happening. Because you need to become educated. It's wrong. The person who comes in brand new and knows nothing and is interested and jumps into the courses, that person will go before you. I will do everything I can, and I will ask everyone around me that has done the right thing to work with me to prevent you from getting in. Take your name off the list. We have 1,000 administrators. Remove your name off the list if you're not going to become educated, because that's a wrongdoing. You have the time right now to get educated, right this minute. And you're wasting time if you're not educating yourself. You're wasting time if you're not preparing yourself by being involved and talking with people and reading the papers and getting involved and helping us to push these doors in so we could take our country, our nation back. It's time to get involved. Jen, are there any announcements?
I have a question for you.
Uh-oh.
And we have an announcement, too. Which would you like first?
You frighten me, Jan. I don't care. Whichever one you want.
Okay, let's run the question first. It's quick and easy. When NLA sends out papers to a named government official, do all other government officials receive notice that papers were sent to that named government official? In other words, do non-named government officials receive something like a carbon copy?
Yeah, we have fax machines. We've been faxing everything out, and we're about to shut them down. The paper's ready to go out, but we are about to shut them down because I can't afford to keep them up no more. Those fax machines cost, I think, about $400 a month to keep them running. We spent thousands of dollars. I don't know, remember how much it was. I don't know if Gary's on the phone. He was participating in the purchasing of those machines, so he may remember, but it was a lot of money. We invested a lot of money in those machines, which wrap out faxes, fax after fax after fax after fax after fax. We have eight lines running constantly. Well, we can fax everyone in government, every state level and the federal level in about 3 days, depending on how many papers. You know, if it's like 5 or 6 or 7 pages, it may take 3 days. If it's less, it could take maybe 2 days or 1 day. So they go out rapidly, quite quickly. I know when I sent out the email telling people that we might have to shut our fax machines down, I got somebody who sent me an email saying that they got a fax machine, they'd be willing to do some faxing. But, you know, you have to understand how this works. You'd have to be sitting at your fax machine dialing numbers all day long. It's not going to work. Well, we have eight automatic things happening all the time. So, you know, that's how we get those words out. So, yeah, that is going out to others. Of course, when we send something to anybody, everybody gets a copy. If there's three, let's say, for instance, we're going after the governor here in New York, which we are, and we're going after both houses here in New York, which we are. So all three get, of course, copies. And then, of course, one gets filed with the court, which is the requirement. That's the way things work. And then, of course, we keep a file here, an original here in the office. So that's what goes out. And then we can fax it out to everyone. Now we have the New York gun thing. We haven't faxed that out yet. I got to get a hold of Gary. We should fax that out, get that moving. And then we have these papers, and we're going to try to fax these out. But those days of faxing are about to end because we don't have enough money to keep things up. Like I said, we've been running a $1,000 deficit every month for about 4 months now. And I've been taken out of my own pocket. I'm not working no more. I just don't have it. And I just, whatever savings I have, it's very minimum at this point because I put way too much into what we're doing here. I need $5 a month from everybody. That's what we need. And some people can order to afford 10, 15, or 20 bucks or more, but I need $5 from everybody. Look at, don't go and get coffee and donuts 1 day a month. I mean, come on, $5 a month. If you can't afford that to save the nation, I don't know, man. I just don't know. Anyway, figured I'd take opportunity of that there, Jen. Go ahead.
Okay. Next, we have Crystal on tap. She's been working with getting education into the school system and would like to tell us a little bit about it.
Good. Yeah, Crystal, I was talking with Crystal earlier. Crystal is really jumping into a lot of things, and people need to listen to what Crystal is doing here because everyone should be doing this. Everyone. You should be working on your grassroots, trying to get things together. It all starts with education. Education is power, okay? That's power, education. Crystal, go right ahead.
Hello?
We got you. Go right ahead, Crystal.
Okay, hi, how are you? Also, I just heard on the news, the sheriff is on a rampage in Austin, Texas, and he's going up on the governor and, I guess, the attorney general tomorrow. So pay attention to him. I saw that. I think it was on MS. I guess there's something going on about the sheriff.
Is this good or bad?
That's good.
Okay. Well, good rampage then. Okay.
Well, they said the sheriff, he's speaking out against the governor and the attorney general. You know, so I think it's something pertaining to where his power is, you know, pertaining.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But also with the schools and stuff like that. We got it in the, we're getting it ready to launch with the high schools. And also another group that's taking the kids to college, so they're all up on it. And another group that's running an after-school program, they want to definitely get involved. And then I just met a team of basketball players from 9th to 12th grade, and now they're excited about it. And, you know, I said, and like, we're going to try to get, I told that we have quite a few retired teachers, and some of the teachers, because with all this supposed funding, this, you know, they're cutting the programs Trump's trying to cut out. I said, well, this would be good even if they do it volunteer, you know, so these kids could come out of school and do the court observer, because the summertime's coming, and also, I guess, what is it, spring vacation. So I said, if we can get things organized where we could take the kids a part of the class trip, as, you know, and they can get credit for it as a work experience. You know, so as I said, it's just like they're all excited about it. And we want to have it like incorporated as a work experience. So if you get a YMCA, we're trying to get more buildings and stuff like that, because we're trying to get things together for summer jobs and all that. So this will be a part of it during the school, after school, and during the summer. You know,
and maybe they can learn how to write an affidavit of what they experience concerning what's going in the courts. You know?
Right, right. Because, you know, even if we get, you know, like as they said, we're trying to get little donations and doing fundraising so we can get pads, pencils. But even going to the court, so I'm in court this week up until next week. And I did get a grand. I said I want a common law jury. When I went to court, because they told me when I filed for the bankruptcy, so I was going to put out my house again, and I said, you know, when I went there, I said, am I a public servant of this court? They said, no. I said, is this my grand jury? And he said, no, he's a grand jury. I said, you just committed a treason. And I said, I want your resignation, at which they threw me out the court. That was back in 2014. So when I went to federal court, I said, if they were perpetrating a fraud, I said, here's my affidavit, and I said, here's my mortgage release and all that stuff. And so one of the utility companies went and put a lien on my property. And I said, you're nothing but the debt collector. And I said, I want a sworn notarized affidavit. So also another thing what I did, and I wasn't even aware that you could do this. You know, when you get your bills from all these people that say that you owe them money? Well, all the attorneys that send me a bill, I put them a part of the bankruptcy court. Well, as a result of it, I said, I want to see a sworn notarized affidavit when I took a loan out, or when did I, you know, ever get a loan or whatever you. The judge discharged my case, so all of them were dismissed. Now, for my case, when I had injured myself, they said, well, you're not going to get nothing. It has to go back to all the debt collectors. I said, oh, really? I went back and I said, well, who's the injured party? And I remembered something many, many years ago. Injured party, if somebody's on disability, or if you get hurt, or if you get hurt on your job, the only thing an attorney can get is only a third of that settlement. And when I asked them this last week, I mean, I was enraged. I went off and on from the trustees and also the attorney. So I got a grand jury. I said, I want a common law grand jury. So we started that. So these are the little, you know, things that we definitely need to, you know, keep in mind and be mindful of it, and also have, bring the people in the court. with the pen and paper and take notes.
Well, amen, and that's the most important thing when we go as court observers, is to bring your paper and pen and make sure you make notes and write an affidavit on behalf of the individual you went there for, because that's what it's all about. You know, write down whatever you see, whatever you experience, because you're going to rest assured once that judge opens his mouth and the other side opens their mouth and they go back and forth, you're going to be recording a conspiracy, okay? And so by all means, make sure you write your papers. And, of course, the kids are too young to be able to use their affidavits, but it would be a good experience for them to write what they saw in the court. However they understand it is good enough. You know, it doesn't mean anything whether they understand what's being said or not, but just that they've recorded it. So they should take a paper and pencil or pen, make notes, and then write a little story and help them make it like an affidavit, so now they learned how to write an affidavit. That's what an affidavit is. Even have them go as far as taking it to the a notary and have it notarized. And even if it's not a notary, you know, maybe to their teacher or someone who would kind of notarize it for them, so to speak, you know, sort of a process for them to understand how things work. But it'd be interesting education for them, I think. So, all right, is that it?
Yeah, basically that's it. Well, okay. I'll be in touch with you because I'll have something to send to you.
All right, appreciate it.
Okay.
That. Okay, and we will be working. We are working right now on mortgages. If you've lost your home to tax foreclosure, if you've lost your home to a mortgage foreclosure, if you are losing your home to a tax or mortgage foreclosure, we might be able to do something for you. We are adding those cases into our New York case. Again, conspiracy. This is what it's all about. These non-judicial foreclosures is nothing but conspiracy. It is a shaking of hands between the judge and the mortgage companies or the towns and the counties in order to make money. It's all about money, robbing our homes for money. And they're not giving the people due process. They're not going through the process of law, and they're taking you into places, jurisdictions unknown, which have no power, no authority in this country, in this nation, anywhere, to take your home away. They just don't have that authority. If they have the proper paperwork to take your home away, then produce it and bring it into a court. But they're not doing it, and they can't do it. That's why they created this non-judicial foreclosure process. Go ahead.
Well, it's just like this, and they can check on their website because I don't have a computer. On your website, that PHH Mortgage, and it was in Columbus, Georgia, I believe. The gentleman was awarded $21 million on that, you know, which I also had some dealings with them, too, because they had changed my mortgage. And this was like around in 2006. And I said, wait a second. And they changed my mortgage. And I'm the one who did my mortgage for 10 years. And they changed it. And then they put me in a variable. And they kept on going up, 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 up. And all of a sudden I said, wait a second. I said, I remember who signed my name to change the mortgage. So when I contacted my attorney, I said, look, I figured it out. I said, they've been perpetrating a fraud, and they've been changing my name. I said, I want a sworn notarized affidavit. And I said, we did a conference call, because, of course, you have to identify who's on the phone and everything. And so I had all my notes and everything. And what had happened, from the CEO on down, I told the attorney, I said, ask him all these questions. I said, please let me ask the last question. And the last question I said, well, who was the person who signed my name? And I want a sworn notarizer. They said, oh, we made a mistake. They sent me the release and everything else, you know, which I should have followed through with that guy I did down in Atlanta, you know?
Yep.
Which
yep,
I can get probably.
It's never too late. Look, in common law court, it's never too late. There's no such thing as a statute of limitations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as long as memory could be made and evidence can be collected, that's all that's necessary to win in a court. And when you discover the fraud and you discover that, oh wow, I could do this. Well, hey, go for it then.
And one other thing too. When I had sent all the people that send me stating I owe them debt, what have you. So you had to send them that paperwork and stuff to follow through. Well, they were sending, one of them were saying, I did never received it or whatever, we'll send it back. Well, of course, so I went back to the court, and I said, isn't a fax legit? They said, yes, good. So I sent it fax. They still tried to say they never received it. So I brought it right back to the federal courthouse. I said, here's when they received it, the first one. Here's when they received it, the second. Amend this to my case. Mm-hmm. And this is the ones who are perpetrating the mortgage fraud.
Right. Yeah, you should go out after them for that that other part, that fraud, because you got them. You got them.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. We'll send you the papers. Yeah.
Okay. But
okay.
I said I... All righty.
Thanks a lot, Crystal. Appreciate
You're
it.
You're welcome.
Anything else? You too. Anything else out there, Jen?
Yes. Next thing we have is Robert with the Western Patriot Report for the week.
Okay. How you doing, Robert?
I'm doing well.
Good.
Well, the big news is out of Nevada. They've outed another informant. Now, this man has been working as an informant since 2012. That's 2 years prior to the Bundy standoff. And during the Bundy standoff, the FBI came out with a phony document crew. You know, they were filming people and interviewing people, and they were getting the people to talk, hoping to use that in court against the Patriots. Well, they all the Patriots were very nice, and they talked about praying and about just being there to help a neighbor and all that kind of thing. One man was full of nasty remarks and just, you know, saying things to give the FBI a reason to make arrests and all of that kind of thing. Well, when it came to last week in court, defense attorney showed clips of this production crew that was filming everything, and they already found out that it was the FBI that had done it, because they were showing clips of it as evidence against the Patriots. And so the defense attorneys were pushing the issue and just kept hammering the prosecutors about it. Is this man an informant? And they named him. And they kept pounding it until one of the prosecutors slipped up and said, yes, he's an informant. And, well, it all comes out whenever they were done. They found out that he had also burglarized the office of one of the defense attorneys to determine what the defense strategy was for one of our Patriots. And that man is the one that everybody felt sorry for, because he wasn't getting the proper medical care in the jail and all that. He's the one that was going blind. Greg Burleson is the name. So he's outed. But they're still being belligerent. One of the defendants was acting as his own attorney. And they let him do that right up until the day before the trial ended. And then they took away his right to defend himself, to work as his own attorney, and made this know-nothing attorney stand in for him that wouldn't even ask any questions for him or anything. And the judge says, you as a defendant have no rights except for three. You can plead guilty. you can testify on your own behalf, or you can appeal the court decision, and that's the only three rights you have. Well, she did this because he asked a question about Daniel Love. Daniel Love is the special agent that was in charge at the Bundy standoff, and he was also at the Malheur County in Oregon, special agent in charge. And he asked the question about Daniel Love's investigation, and right in front of the jury, and all of the prosecutors came on glued, objecting, because they didn't want, they'd made a ruling that nobody could talk about the special agents being investigated by Congress and all. So it was all we don't know yet. There's no court this week. It ended last Friday. So we don't know what's happening yet. We don't know what the verdict is going to be yet. But the one day when all this happened, showing the clips of what everybody, from the film crew, the jury left with tears in their eyes. I think they realized what the truth was and is. And they all left visibly shaken from it, what they learned that day. So we don't know yet. But that's what I have.
Okay.
Right.
Thanks
now.
A lot, Robert.
Yeah.
Okay, Jan, back to you. Anything else?
Nope. That's the extent of what I have for the evening. That's all yours.
Okay, Gerard, you got anything before we move forward? It's the button on the left side. Unmute. Well, maybe he's not here. Okay, we'll go forward. All right, let's move over. We're going to go now to Brent. I see Brent is here. Brent Winters is the author of The Excellent in Common Law. His website is commonlawyer.com, and he's going to speak to us about something tonight. Brent, you got the mic. Go right ahead. Gerard, if you hear me and you get back, signal me that you're back and I'll pass the board over to you. Go ahead, Brent. Brent's it's still muted. Star 6, you should be able to mute yourself. If not, Jan will unmute you.
Is that the 315?
317, it looks like. 515. I'll get him. I'll unmute him. Okay, you should be unmuted. Did you mute him? I thought I knew.
No.
Let me try him again. He done himself.
Good.
Go ahead. There you go.
I found my button. Well, thanks, Tom. And this is Brent. And the only remedy to the lawlessness we see about us is true law. And one of those expressions that has been so powerful for us on our behalf has been our own Constitution of the United States, an observation of true law written down, as was Magna Carta, as was the English Bill of Rights, as has been the covenants of the Covenanters in Scotland, as has been the state constitutions of our several states. But our Constitution of the United States has become a prototype of the brief of common law government. And it arranges its bones for me, our government, says the Supreme Court of the United States. I'm quoting, it arranges the bones for me, our government, in the language of the common law. That's what the Supreme Court said. I think they hit the nail with their head. Our Declaration of 76, that breathes spirit of our common law into our Constitution, moistening its marrow and awakening its frame. Without our declaration, our Constitution remains a dry and dispirited skeleton of words. It is the declaration that brings life to to our Constitution. Why? Well, because our Declaration is the record of a real case of controversy. A while ago, the idea of standing was mentioned. Standing before the courts, how do you have standing? Well, our Constitution says to have standing in the federal court, you have to bring a real case of controversy. What does that mean? That means you've got to have a real fight. There has to be real rights at stake, and the people that bring them, it has to be their rights. It can't be somebody else's. And if there are real rights at stake, a real injury, as you mentioned a while ago, a potential chilling of free speech or a potential chilling of one's exercise of religion or chilling of many of the fundamental rights, that you have standing. And that standing becomes enlivened because it's a real case. Well, the Declaration of 76 sets forth a real case of people that really had standing, and while that was being written, they had been injured. They were, as it were, a bloody plaintiff. And our Declaration of 76 is a common law complaint. The reason for our Declaration of 76 is that the king, King George III, and his cronies refused to honor our common law in the British American colonies. Our common law is the lifeblood, backbone of our Constitution. And these two documents taken together form the best brief of common law government ever penned, and form a solid foundation upon which to build a true understanding of freedom, possible only according to the course of our common law. The course. Our common law is a way of doing things. It's not a list of laws. It's a way of living, a way of thinking, a course, an action, a road that the fellow must stay on. We call it sometimes due process. Although our Declaration of 76 is called the Declaration of Independence, nowhere does our Declaration use that phrase. In fact, to call this document the Declaration of Independence gives the false impression that we have declared ourselves independent of everyone. We have not. And our Declaration of 76 does not declare us independent of everyone. Instead, our Declaration declares our shifting of reliance by shifting our association, shifting our loyalty, and shifting our trust. We declare, by our Declaration of 76, a shifting of association from Britain. That's, by the way, under the freedom of association. The flip side of that is freedom of disassociation. We declare our disassociation from Britain to associating as states united. Before our Declaration of 76, each of the colonies were, as a matter of fact, independent countries. By the Declaration of 76, we declare an association of 13 original states, a fellowship of separation from Britain's empire, and joining forces in common defense. Again, freedom of association. That's what our Declaration of 76 is fundamentally all about. Disassociating from Britain, associating freely together for the common defense, the 13 colonies. Second, we declared our shift of loyalty from Britain. Listen to the words of the Declaration of 76. They say this: these colonies are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown. Shifting of allegiance from the British Crown to the United States, the signers stating for evidence, they said this, the Declaration of 76 said, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. So first, a shift of association by disassociating from Britain. Second, we declared a shift of loyalty from Britain. Third, we declared our shift of reliance upon Britain for protection, to reliance upon God, the God of all providence. And the final paragraph of the Declaration of 76 declares in whom we trust. It says this, I'm quoting, appealing to the supreme judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions and for support of this declaration with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence. The phrase supreme judge of all the world and the phrase divine providence both refer to the maker of all things, the God of all creation. And by the way, we know of a surety that it refers more particularly to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of the Bible, not the God of Islam, not the God of Romanism, not the God of Judaism, not any other God, the God of that collection of books, 66 books, we call the Bible. We'll talk about that, Lord willing, if we get to that phrase. At bottom, our declaration never declares then our independence from anyone, except to declare a shift of dependence for protection, shifting from Britain to the supreme judge of all the world, to divine providence. Our declaration then goes further, giving the facts justifying our separation from Britain's empire. In a word, King and the Parliament of Britain, through bureaucrats using devices of domination of the law of the city, the civil law, namely under the labels admiralty, administrative, canon, and martial law, those are the three labels to which our Declaration of 76 referred. But they were scheming to keep British American colonists from enjoying their common law freedoms. Now, the colonists knew that England called her land free soil, the land of the British island. And they said this because they said the common law applied to any person whose foot touched the soil of England. They said the soil of England was free soil. Your foot touches it. Doesn't matter what your former condition of servitude may have been. You are at that point, and this is the doctrine of the common law, you are at that point, if so facto, forever free. You see, they believe, at bottom, that common law, the law of the land, arose from the land. And it is the land that gives a man freedom. Important concept. They believe that the law of God, the maker of heaven and earth, came from his abode in the heaven. The heavens, plural, to the land, and was communicated from thence to man. And God made the land, all of the land, and the land is sacred, is precious to him, and still is, by the way, all the land of the earth, not just the land of that place called England. There have been a good many people that have gotten the false impression that the parcel of real estate upon which their foot was, upon which they dwell, is more important than some other parcel of real estate. There are those today that believe that the land of Canaan today, controlled by the state of Israel, is more precious to God than any other land on the planet. That is patently false. It is clearly unbiblical. This land is precious to God. He gave it to us, and he doesn't want it defiled. And that can be shown by the evidence that God has given in his law of testimony. So the free soil doctrine is a good doctrine. It was applied here in America, by the way. But it is not to be confined to any particular parcel of real estate. That's the problem people get in their own national pride, their own pride in their own race, even. They get that way. Now, God doesn't intend that. God gives land to all people, and all people, all men, depend somehow, some way, on land. Even if you live on a houseboat, you depend on land. And you can't survive long if you don't get back to land after you leave land. The land is not something, it's to the law of the land, it is everything. Magna Carta's phrase, law of the land, Stephen Langton drafted it in Latin. He wrote lex terra, that means land law or law of the land, means, in our English-speaking world, if this is the way it has been intended, it means common law due process. And it was so called because they said it was innate in the soil, as we said a while ago, the land. But England denied the deeming of the American soil to being free and deemed her colonists as being less blessed than were they living in England on the Isle of Britain. I don't say these things in passing. This is what they wrote. This is what they said. This is what men believe. And the American colonist, in short, said, well, you can tell that to the people over in Pakistan and India and other parts of your empire because they flat don't know the difference. But we know the difference because we're British like you. And that was the mistake that England made. They pushed it too far, and they pushed it on people that would tolerate it. All those others may not have known the difference and didn't fight with them about it. But once you deny that soil is free as a matter of common law, you deny the common law. And if you deny the common law, then you say the people that live on that soil don't have the common law. If they don't enjoy the common law and the rights of the common law, the due process of the common law, the freedom of speech, the right to a free press, the right to self-defense, in this case with firearms. And so they set about to take away all of those rights. And not take away those rights, you can't take them away, but to squelch our enjoyment of those rights. British Americans then disagreed with England, Parliament, the King, and they laid claim at Concord and Lexington, for instance, to their common law right to keep and bear arms. By the way, I heard this morning in the news, I read that North Dakota legislature has stated that the concealed carry permit for North Dakota was found by reading the Second Amendment of the United States Constitution. It is a constitutional carry state. And it looks like that the whole idea, consistently, sure-footedly, slowly, but sure-footedly, is catching on. Our Declaration of 76 is no scholar's drivel, but puts the paper American convictions then on the anvil, at that very moment, on the anvil trial by battle, and at that very moment being tested in the throes of war. As one fellow said, when the men picked up their quill pens, those 56 men picked up their quill pens to breathe their names to the Declaration of 76, the reek of gunpowder hung in their noses. They were familiar with the brutalities and the aggressions of war because their relatives had brought it to their shores in no small way. Government only has one tool to get its will. That is force and threat of force. They don't have anything else. As Washington put it, government is fire, dangerous. Can be a good friend, but out of control, it's extremely dangerous. That's what happened. The first and last paragraphs of our Declaration of 76 together follow the prophet Isaiah, chapter 33, verse 22, wherein Isaiah acknowledges God to be the spring and the holder of all three powers of government, legislative, executive, and judicial. The God of creation holds all three of those powers in a single will. And he, by the way, the Bible tells us, has delegated all of that to his Messiah. But God says to us, and you see this clearly in the pages of the Bible, he says to us, while this age of the government of men, while he has delegated government to us, we are not to allow all three powers of government to migrate into the hands of a single will, whether a single will of one man or the single will of a combined group of men, such as a legislature, combining their will into one. We are not to let that happen. Now, there are places in the Bible where men try to take all three powers of government, legislative, executive, and judicial, to themselves. And when they did that, God moved in quick and ended that person's power. King Saul is a prime example. He exercised two of the powers of government. He tried to exercise the third one. God ripped the kingdom from him and turned it over to David, his servant. In England, two powers of government can be held in one will, but never three. That's the common law standard. But here in America, our Constitution separates all three and says, as a matter of standard, no one will can have any two of the powers of government, legislative, executive, and judicial, held in a single will with a single person. Well, Isaiah 33:22 acknowledges the three powers of government in the God of creation. It says there, he is legislator of his laws. Our Declaration of 76 references the laws of nature and of nature's God. Paragraph 1. It says there in Isaiah 33 that he is the enforcer of his laws. That's the executive power. Our Declaration of 76 acknowledges this. It says with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence. And Isaiah chapter 33, verse 22, then also says that he is the judge of his laws. And our Declaration of 76, paragraph 32 says, acknowledges the supreme judge of all the world. Except in the Godhead, both the Bible and our common law forbid that these three powers ever be gathered into the hands of any single will of mere men, whether one man, or a combination of men, a legislator, a trading monopoly, a banking cartel, or even a bureaucracy, a single will. God forbids it, and judgment will come if it happens. I think we've seen that in our own lifetimes. If you've lived at all very long, if you're an adult, look around the world. The just reason for independence of one country from domination by another is to secure personal, individual freedom. In fact, freedom, at bottom, is never, watch me close, never a group or corporate right, never. And freedom is always, and must be, and it is, an individual right, and any talk otherwise is intended to deceive. There are no such things as group rights. When men go to court in our common law courts here in America, it is individuals that are defended. The rights of individuals. Rights, yes, the jurisdiction, the responsibility of the individual. And if those are not defended individually, the only way you can defend them, then they don't exist in practice, and we don't have them. We don't enjoy them. Well, even freedom of association, of which we speak often in the First Amendment of our United States Constitution, freedom of association to associate or to disassociate with a group of others is an individual right. Even though it takes more than one person to do it, it's still an individual right. And some of our founders sought independency from men and dependency upon God, that they would each be free to choose and obey the duties of conscience, their freedoms demanded. And the rights of conscience are indeed beyond the just reach of any human power. I'm quoting Justice Joseph Story, the longest-serving member of a United States Supreme Court. Not only that, but the youngest man, I believe, ever appointed to our Supreme Court. He said this, "The rights of conscience are indeed beyond the just reach of any human power. They are given by God and cannot be encroached upon by human authority." without criminal disobedience of the precepts of natural as well as revealed religion. Natural as well as revealed religion. Natural law is nature's unwritten law, and revealed religion is scripture. And that's the two volumes of God's revelation of his will to man, to which Justice Joseph's story refers. Well, we come now to the text of our Declaration of 76, but we're not going to dive into it this time. I'm going to make a couple of quotes in introduction, and then, Lord willing, if I come back, we'll dive into it next time. First, I want to quote William Blackstone, and always go on the truth. And I say this by one of my favorite quotes: "He who never quotes is never quoted." Blackstone, in his commentary, is the first volume, the year 1765, wrote this: "In our American plantations, the common law has no authority. In our American plantations, the common law has no authority. Why? Well, as I'd said in the beginning of the presentation this evening, the North American colonies were not free soil. The common law did not arise from it or attach to it. Our common law has no authority in the American colonies, the American plantations. Listen to the United States Congress, its first convening, 14 October 1774. They made this resolution and put it to writing. They said, resolved that the respective colonies are entitled to the common law of England, and more especially to the great and inestimable privilege of being tried by the peers of the vicinage according to the course of that law." According to the course of what law? The common law of England. He cites two things here. He, the Congress of the United States, I should say, they cite the inestimable privilege of trial by jury. They call it being tried by the peers of their vicinage. They're lifting those words out of Magna Carta. And then they say this: according to the course of that law. According to the course of the common law. What is the course of the common law? It is, we call it, our Constitution calls it, the law of the land. What does the law of the land mean? It means due process. Due process, the law of the land, the course of our common law itself, is a course, it is a way, it is a process. And it is process-oriented, not result-oriented. And that's what sets us apart from the world of the law of the city. That's all I have tonight. John, thank you again for inviting me. And I like to add, my views are not necessarily the views of NLA. Sometimes they are, probably. And I appreciate the opportunity, them letting me come on and present my point of view. Gerard, are you on there?
Should be here somewhere. He's muted. Gerard, you're unmuted. Gerard? I'll mute him and unmute him. That might get his attention. Or maybe not. Maybe John's still here. Let's check John.
Can you hear me now? Hello, testing.
Yep, we can hear you.
Okay, all right. Having trouble getting through there. Okay, we'll go take questions. Let me open up the Q&A, and if anybody's got any questions, star 6 to get in. And as I mentioned earlier, we're going to be going through the processes for the the foreclosures. So anybody who has to have that done, you know, just connect. We have a page up. Well, let me see where we put that page. I think we put it under the grand jury, didn't we? Let me see. Yeah, under the grand jury.
Non-judicial foreclosure, yeah.
Yep, there it is. Hopefully we'll get open the habeas corpuses again. I'd like to get them open. We're still working on training people on that. So we'll get back to that as soon as we get moving on the habeas, on these foreclosures. So. Okay, let's take our first person in, Eric VoIP dialer. Go right ahead, Eric. You got the mic.
John, I was going to mention that Crystal brought up this case in Austin. The sheriff, and the sheriff, I believe, is a woman, and the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott. I was actually going to do this as my first foray into blogging for NLA. I was thinking about calling it what I assume would be the first in a series of blogs entitled Ignorance in Action, part of a series, because I just assumed these things will keep coming up because no one knows what we're being taught here. You know, few people know what we're being taught here by you and Brett. Anyway, both the sheriff, it is interesting in regard to the fact that both the sheriff and the governor appear to be in the wrong and kind of in the right. For example, the governor wants to clamp down on sanctuary cities. So the a Democratic Hispanic woman, Sally Hernandez, is the sheriff. And so Travis County leaders condemned losing $1.5 million in grant money earmarked for crime victim services, courts, and other programs, but they stand by the sheriff. So there you go. If that's federal money, and I assume it is, they're suckling at the federal teat, so they don't want to do that because they lose power by doing that. So they're in the wrong there. Then Travis County Judge Sarah Eckhart writes to Abbott saying, quote, I am certain you have come to the same conclusion, else you would not be seeking to change current state law to put all Texas sheriffs in the service of the United States Department of Homeland Security, saying that obviously he doesn't believe he actually has the power to do this, so now he's trying to rewrite some legislation or get the legislators to write this. Now here's the ignorance in action part that I find to be most troubling. And that is where a Senate committee on Thursday is expected to vote on a bill that would deny, and this was from a few weeks back, state grant funds to jurisdictions that discourage inquiring into the immigration status of a person under lawful detention or arrest. The Governor Abbott has also called for the power to remove locally elected officials if they don't comply. So he's going to ask for that in the legislation. That's the real scary part to me, the ignorance and action, because as you said before, an elected official cannot remove another elected official. It subverts our government. So anyway, that's why I thought it would be interesting. So what Crystal was saying was, yeah, keep an eye on this. It could be pretty interesting. But then my question for Brent.
I'm not too sure I understand exactly, though. Explain it a little further if you can. What you're telling me now is that the what exactly is the sheriff trying to do?
The sheriff doesn't the sheriff says the city jails would no longer honor most federal immigration detainers. So the governor is trying to take Trump's new executive actions against sanctuary city policies and kind of rev it up. And so the sheriff saying that her jails going forward would only honor immigration holds in murder, aggravated sexual assault, and human trafficking cases. So the sheriff is saying that the governor doesn't have the right to tell her what to do, I believe, in these situations and enforce these, what she believes are unconstitutional actions, such as questioning people when she doesn't have the right to question them, only in cases of, you know, aggravated sexual assault, trafficking, and murder. Is she going to do this? And so the governor is saying, yeah, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do even more. And the part that really caught my attention was that he wants to get his legislators to write in legislation that would allow him to remove elected officials if he doesn't like what they're doing. And that's the real subversion part.
Right. Yeah, that's the danger point.
So. That's real danger. But I wanted to do a little more research on it before I did it. Of course, I want it to be timely. But anyway, I just thought that, yeah, that it is an interesting case. But anywho, my question for you and Brent is, you know, Brent, and this seems to match up with my, you know, internal wisdom from my creator father, that marriage is not at all a contract, but it's a vow. And then, but you did mention that it was a contract, but the state shouldn't be involved. So I agree with both of those. But I'd like to hear you both expound on that a bit. Is it really a contract? Because I think Brent was saying that for 1,000 years, maybe even close to 2,000 years, it's just been a vow. But now we're being taught, like we are so many things, the wrong thing. So if you guys...
Yeah, I think the government has turned it into a contract. But yeah, I agree with you. It's a vow. We exchange vows. That's the saying. So, and the Bible is clear concerning divorce and that nature of things. Matter of fact, I was just looking in the Bible. Maybe we'll read one of those things one of these coming up weeks. But yeah, I agree. I think it's a vow. Brent, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I'd agree. A contract is a promise that the law will enforce. That's the best definition I've ever come across or seen concerning the definition of contract. A contract is a promise the law will enforce. Well, when we say, for example, exchange of vows, that's a senseless statement because vows can't be exchanged. Vows are promises made direct to God. When two people get married, I know what we mean when we say that, but when people get married, each one of them makes a promise to God. That's what a vow is. A vow doesn't have need then to call God in to witness the promise and force it. When you're making a promise to another man, you take an oath and you call God in to witness the promise and enforce it. But when you're promising direct to God by ceremony, he's there. You don't have to call him in. So that's the difference between an oath and a vow. A vow is a promise made direct to God. An oath supports a promise made direct to man. It calls God in to witness. But a contract is a promise the courts will enforce. God will enforce his vows, so it's a contract, but it's not a contract, you see, between a man and a woman. It's a contract with God. It's a promise to God, and God, he promises to enforce vows. Be careful what you vow. And if it is a contract, you see, that destroys marriage for this reason. Because a contract, such as we say at common law, if one party breaches their end of the contract, that relieves the other party from the contract. That's not what marriage is. Anybody that's been married a decade or two or more is going to come to the conclusion sooner or later that they've broken their responsibilities to their spouse pretty steadily. And that doesn't end the marriage, for crying out loud. I mean, any breach of God's law to your spouse, if that's all it is, a contract, it relieves your spouse of any more duties toward you. Well, that's not what God intended. That's why we take vows. And we have forgotten that. People get married. Most people stay married all their life. Even if they stay married all of their lives, they don't have a clue what marriage is. We said a while ago, it's been that way for 2,000 years. No, it's been that way for however many years it's been since the Garden of Eden. Because Jesus Christ refers back to the Garden of Eden at the very beginning when he talks about marriage. That's the standard. That's the touchstone. That's where it all starts, and everything we can glean out of that is the way God wants us to view marriage in our own day. Go ahead.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
That's wonderful.
All right, Eric, anything else? Anybody else got any questions? Star 6 to get into the queue. There's no one in the queue. That's unusual. Usually there's quite a few people in the queue. But anyway, anything else, Eric?
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Okay, let's go to Greg from Florida. You got the mic, Greg. Go right ahead.
Hey, I just had a little comment on the immigration issues. I actually watched the Chris Ann Hall show this afternoon that was right on that subject, and it was a replay from December of 2015, and she states that this was Obama saying, you know, allowing sanctuary cities, and she quoted the Article 6. I'm trying to remember the exact number now because it was, like, surprising that it was on the subject matter. But, you know, you can review that whole thing, and she explains it really clearly that the president doesn't have any kind of rights to give any kind of sanctuary cities anywhere in the Constitution or sanctuary to refugees. There's no clause for that in the Constitution. The only people that have rights, you know, the responsibility for regulating the naturalization is Congress. And she made that very clear, and she stated the exact articles in the Constitution. And so that's all I have, just a comment on that part. And it sounds like that the sheriff in Austin maybe needs to learn the Constitution a little more, too, as well as the governor, of course. That's all I had.
Okay. Appreciate that. All right, we'll take our next caller, 737 number. Don't have a name. What's your name, first name, and your state? 737.
This is Jason from Texas in Travis County. I actually live here in Travis County, where that new sheriff is at. I'm good. How are y'all?
Good, thank you.
Good. I haven't been here in a while. I didn't have internet and stuff like that, but I just got everything back together, and I'm kind of coming back into the picture. And especially with the recent events with this new sheriff, it's been kind of a big controversy here. And I want to set up a meeting with her and see if I can, you know, sit and talk with her and get more information and then discuss with her, you know, her power, and make sure she understands that she has the ultimate power, and that, you know, Governor Abbott doesn't have any rights to tell her one way or another what she does. And I think that hopefully if I have that meeting with her, I can find out what she does know about that and maybe find out what's actually going on, because there's so many different stories on the news and at Facebook and everywhere else. You know, it's hard to find out what it actually is, what's actually happening. So that I'm hoping to find out here next week if I can get that meeting. But unfortunately, when I call the sheriff's department, they're not very cooperative with just kind of patching me through to her. So I'm going to send some emails today and see if I can get a response from her. And if that doesn't work, then I'll even go in there in person and ask to speak to her. I'm just going to stay on it until they let me actually finally talk to her.
Right, yeah, do keep us advised on whatever you learn. We appreciate that. Right.
Yeah,
anything else?
If y'all have any information, I know that normally each person in whatever county is supposed to meet with the sheriff anyway. If y'all have any information that I can bring with me that she can direct to me or send to my my account, and then I can print it out and bring it in there with me. Any paperwork that I can...
Well, we do have something. We have a book up there. It's a jurist book, jurist handbook, and it's also for sheriffs. And we also have a paper called The Power of the Sheriff. You can find that under sheriffs and highlight sheriff on the bar, the blue bar, and then click on The Power of the Sheriff.
Yeah, I have that one up now, The Power of the Sheriff.
Yeah, I'm trying to think where we have the, it's maybe on the free courses that we have it. Yeah, Free Common Law Handbook. I think that might be it. I think that's what we named it. Hang on a second, open it up. Yeah. Common Law Handbook for Jurors, Sheriffs, Bailiffs, and Justices. Okay, a lot of this has to do with the sheriff. We wrote a lot of this with the sheriff in mind. So it's under free courses all the way down on the bottom. You'll see Free Common Law Handbook. You can print that out. That's a good book to give them. It's 29 pages of stuff, and it really lays out the law. You also, we're going to add a little more to that probably coming soon, so hopefully it'll update soon. We're going to add some of the stuff that we wrote in for the law and statutes, the difference between statutes and law, make it a little more clearer in this book. So,
well, I plan on taking that course as well, because I'm taking the civics course now for the grand jury administrator thing, so I'm going to take all the courses and get all the information that I can.
Yeah, let the sheriff know, if you talk with the sheriff, that there's a courses up here that are free for him to take.
Yeah, absolutely. The
constitutional course and there's the civics course. He should take both of them. You know?
Okay. Yeah. Well, hopefully she does. That'd be great if she was to log in and read that information. Unfortunately, from my understanding, is she's, you know, more democratic liberal, I guess. So. Mm-hmm. I don't know how open she will be to some of these things, but hopefully she's just more not worried about a political side and more worried about the Constitution is what I'm hoping for.
Right. And you should impress that upon her if she doesn't, that is what she should be interested in, not the politics, but the Constitution. Not the statutes, but the law, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's my
okay.
I'm hoping to go to the best on our road.
All right. Anything else?
No, that's it for now.
Okay. Appreciate the call. All right. Let's take our next caller. Again, star six, anybody wants to get into the queue. There's not too many people in the queue right now. Star six to get into the queue. Next caller, VoIP caller, Richard. Richard, what state you're from? Richard, what state you're from? VoIP dialer coming in off of the browser. Richard, I think I hear something in the background. Last call for Richard, the VoIP dialer. Okay, I guess Richard walked away from his computer maybe. Let's try David. Go ahead, David. What's your state?
I'm Dave. I'm in the state of Missouri.
How you doing, Dave?
Pretty good. In that letter that you had, that you're sending out on the standing, somebody being standing.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. You mentioned jurors in all the states except Missouri. Was
all
there
right.
not any in Missouri, or did
sure,
you fail to?
Maybe I missed it somehow, but I'm sure we got people in Missouri. We
well,
got
I would
state
think
here.
So, yes, sir.
Yeah, let me take a quick look and see what we got.
Okay.
Okay, Missouri. It was done in alphabetical order, so it should be pretty quick. H-I-J-K. Missouri. 115 jurists from Missouri. I remember reading that, so... You must have been listened at that very moment.
115, did you say?
115 in Missouri, yeah.
And how many is from Michigan?
Michigan. 268 from Michigan.
Okay, so we got 115 in Missouri. Okay, the other thing, I was listening to Crystal, who's trying to get something done in education in Texas. And for what it might be helpful to her, I am in contact with some lady by the name of Donna Garner from Texas, and she's an ex-teacher, but she carries clout in Texas. So if I could get some way to get in touch with Crystal, either by phone or by email, I could send her some information on this lady.
All right, get in touch with Jan, and he'll connect you with Crystal.
Okay, very good.
Well, Jan,
that's all I've got.
Right, anyway.
Yeah,
Jan.
Crystal is from Connecticut.
Yeah.
But she's working
Texas.
On something in Texas?
No.
I thought I was in Connecticut, not Texas.
Yeah, she's in Connecticut working on something in Connecticut.
Yeah.
In Connecticut?
Yeah.
Well, I
yep.
must have bad hearing tonight. I thought.
Yeah, we're going to have to
you
send you some
Missouri
hearing aid.
Connecticut.
Yeah. Okay.
Watch it.
I stand recommend. I mean, yeah, corrected. Thank you.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's take our next caller here. Let's see, 901 area code. You've been unmuted. What's your first name and your state?
Is this the call?
Yep, this is the call. Hey. What's your first name and your state?
This is Richard.
How you doing, Richard? What state you from?
I'm in Tennessee.
Tennessee. Go right ahead.
One of those pesky non-foreclosure states. As a matter of fact,
all states seem to be a non-foreclosure, a non-judicial foreclosure states, because even New York, which is not a non-judicial foreclosure state, does non-judicial foreclosures. They don't care. They don't even care about even making the law up anymore. So, but go right ahead.
I just found your site not too, I think about a week ago or so, and I referred to a gentleman, Ed of Abodia, .com, and he might on his site referred me to you guys. And what happened was in February, I was forced out of my home. And I'm just trying to look for an avenue where I can get back what I lost some kind of way.
Right. Well, you can fill out a form. We have a form up there. We're just starting to take papers for people who have non-judicial foreclosures. We have certain requirements in order to go forward. You know, we give things away for free. We don't charge anything, but, you know, it does cost money to do these things, so we do ask for a donation to be given to National Liberty Alliance. And National Liberty Alliance funds all the necessary costs for the grand jury to send out its paperwork and, you know, pay for the mailing and the certification and so on and so forth.
We'll lock it.
But anyway, you can find that, goodness, where did we put that? Let's see, where did we put that? Did we put it under... maybe grand jury. Where did we put that paperwork for that coming in for the non-judicial foreclosure? It's under grand jury. If you highlight the grand jury on the blue bar all the way on the right-hand side, second from the last, you highlight that, and you come down and you'll see non-judicial foreclosure. And if you click on the non-judicial foreclosure there, you'll find a form and instructions. And fill out the form and you know, just follow the instructions, and we'll work to try to help you with that. We're just starting this again, like everything else. Everything's an uphill battle, but we're getting closer and closer. We feel and we're doing what's called a show cause. They got to answer. They can't ignore it. They got to answer. And if they can't answer, they default. And if they default, then they have to restore you. And I suspect they're going to restore it. They're going to default.
Okay.
Because the only thing they can do is
like
try to
that.
Say that we don't have standing. What'd you say, Jen?
Pardon, just skip it.
Okay. The only thing they can try to do is to do the no standing thing. The governor here in New York has already tried that, and we're ready to respond to that. And he did it on a paper. He didn't even have to answer. It was really ridiculous the way that whole paperwork went with him. And it showed their arrogance, because if they would have just read it, you know, they said that the way they responded was real silly. But in any event, we're going to come in with the no standing memorandum and make it clear. And we're going to let the judge know that he better not try to get in there and make any decisions, because that's not his job. This is not an equity case. This is a court of record. And he's going to understand soon that this court of record is going to be turned criminal also. We're going to do indictments inside this case. You know, extraordinary times calls for extraordinary, responses. And so we're going to do something I don't think anyone's ever done before. But, hey, why not? Why can't it be done, you know? But anyway, that's what you could do if you we'll try to help you.
Okay, yeah, because they came in with guns drawn. One guy, a couple of guys had AR-15s and all this.
Yeah, it's insane. These people are insane. What was this, a tax foreclosure or mortgage?
Mortgage.
Mortgage foreclosure. Yeah, these people are insane. Yeah, make sure you get all that in your affidavit. When you write up your affidavit, tell your story exactly how it happened from beginning to end, you know?
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right, anything else?
That's it. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Richard. Okay, let's take our next caller. Let's see. It is 541. You've been unmuted. What's your first name and your state? 541.
Yeah, this is Gunter Ambron here in Oregon.
From Oregon. What's
Hello,
your first
John.
Name? How you doing?
Gunter.
Gunter. Oh, how you doing, Gunter?
Yeah, doing okay. Yeah, we've been so busy over here. I haven't had much time to. I have been getting in on the state calls there for the committees of safety and talked with Gary. So I told him I would be in on this call, but our community watch meeting that we tried to get the COS started last year, but there was too much flack with call me out being politics, you know. So I changed the name to a community watch community watch committee, and kind of been flying that under the radar. So we're working with the lawlessness at both ends of the scale here. Here we have the street, the addicts, and the thieves on the street level, and then we have the ones in our courts as well. So it's just been a big process of education. So I just wanted to let you guys know that I'm still out here. I'm still rooting for you, and I'm part of the National Liberty Alliance, and we'll be meeting and utilizing a lot of your work that you have done to get us into a Republican mode over here. We have also the State of Jefferson group that is working long and tall with the building coalitions of liberty groups, what we're doing over here. And we're seeing now more and more how important it is that we all get on the same page and work on a substantial project like this, opening up the common law courts and the grand jury and committees of safety. So yeah, I just wanted to let you know I'm still around.
Okay,
and I'll be in.
Keep busy.
You bet. Yep. I'll be in on the Wednesday call with Gary and them, and I'll give you a report back in a couple of weeks because we have a big meeting coming up next Monday, and with the city and the county, and then I'll give you a report back. We have some canvassing that we're doing, a big canvassing project that we're getting on the way next week we have a list of contacts of people that are pretty much ready. They just need to get the other foot over the fence, so to speak, and get them in on the committee. So I'll get a report back to you in a couple of weeks. Sure. Thank you.
All right. Appreciate it. Thank you.
You
okay,
bet.
Okay. Let's take our next caller. Let's see. 806 phone number. You've been unmuted. What's your first name and your state? And anybody wants to get into the queue, star 6 to get into the queue. We only got a couple people in the queue. Go ahead.
Okay.
First name and state.
It's RM from Texas.
How you doing, RM?
Well, I wish I was doing better, but right now what I'm dealing with is I've got 3 criminal trespasses onto my home property. Never once was I caught on the property. The house is still in my name. We're divorced. I got divorced in May. I was living in the house until November of last year. The question I have, the county judge is good friends with my wife as well, or my ex-wife, as well as the sheriff. They're all good friends. They use a stingray up here where I'm at, and so that's how they knew I was on the premises. But what is your thoughts on how to proceed in regards to this, because I know somebody's got to be hurt in order for a crime to be committed. However, they got statutes and all that, so I don't know what I'm charged with, but they may make it try to be, since they caught me 3 times in a week, they may make it pretty hard on me. What is the best way to remedy this situation?
Yeah, I don't know that we can give you any advice, you know, especially
no.
in a divorce thing with
the Well, divorce
situation.
I'm not worried about. No,
right,
no,
but there's a question concerning the home, right?
Well, no, there's not a question on the home. The home's still in my name. The mortgage is still in my name. And the insurance is still in my name. Mm-hmm. The thing is, how can I criminally trespass on my own property?
Well, that's a good question. She doesn't have an order of protection or anything like that on you, right?
Never once been mentioned to me.
Okay. So
she was out of town also. She was out of town that whole week when I was there when I was getting arrested. Well, the first day she didn't. Mm. I mean, anyway.
Yeah, I don't have any advice here for you.
No. I just thought I would throw it out.
Yeah. Yeah, I what we do is the only things that we really get involved with is things that really prove a conspiracy. Like, let's take these non-judicial foreclosures. Clearly,
yes,
there's a conspiracy going through the courts. All the judges are in on it. The mortgage companies are in on it. The lawyers are in on it. Even on the tax foreclosures, because they do it the exact same way.
They have a stingray system as well as they have undercover cops, and they've been circling me and tracking me all around town for the last, since at least November. But that's beside the point. But
if you really feel that you're being harassed or something and you think you have a case and that you've got documentation, you could go to maybe the county next door and file a complaint there and see what can happen in the court. Not that you're going to get justice these days, but who knows? You know, sometimes because you're not going up directly against the government, you might have a chance. But the problem would be also is the fact that you got the sheriff and you said the judge also. They're part of the bureaucratic process, so you know they'll get a wink, a nod, and a handshake in the back room from the county next door, maybe. So I don't know what to tell you on that, you know. Hopefully soon we'll get into the courts. We'll have the proper grand jury administrators, and you could take your story to the grand jury, and the grand jury could make some phone calls and fix the problem. Or
yes, no, I appreciate your advice. Thank you.
Bye bye. Okay, let's go to the next caller. It's a 737 number. What's your first name and your state?
Hey, this is Jason again. I'm from Texas. I heard another gentleman on there asking, it sounded like he was trying to talk to me, but he was asking for some girl.
Okay.
He said he had information on the sheriff here in Travis County in Texas. And if he's still on the line, and hears me, I'd like to get a hold of him and talk with him. And anybody else that's in Travis County or Texas Theory that's in the room.
Do you want to give your phone number? If you want to put
your phone number,
go right ahead. I put my phone number out there all the time. I never had a problem, so.
Yeah, I don't mind at all. That's fine. The number is 737-202-1630. And that's for anyone in Texas period, especially Travis County, that wants to contact me about this particular issue and also just organizing in general, because I don't think Travis County has maybe but two other members in their period, and I haven't really heard from any of them. And also, if you know any ways that I can get a hold of more members that may be in this area that I know about,
get a hold
so I can
of
help
Jan.
Them.
Get a hold of Jan, and he'll connect you with the members, if not in your county. The county's close to you, and you know, give you some list of people that you can work with. You know, two or three, four, five, six people working together work better than one. And even as long as they're not too far away from you, you probably do some things. You can at least have some meetings online too. You know, so.
Yeah, that'd be cool too. Yeah, anything that helps get it together. And let me throw my number out there one more time. It's 737-202-1630, and you can text or call, whichever it may be, for this or your videos.
Okay, thank you.
And then I'll get a hold of you after that, too. Thank you.
Alrighty. Okay, let's go to our next caller, 817. You can unmute it. Go right ahead. Give us your first name and your state.
This is John from Texas.
Hey, John.
What I want to ask you is, I haven't listened to you in, last couple of weeks. What it involves is a non-judicial foreclosure. I was foreclosed in January 2016. Well, the problem is I paid for the property four times. The note was for $82,900, and they lowered it to $32,500. I paid in just a tad less than $135,000. What I was wondering is, the document that you were been working on the last few weeks, did you complete it?
Yeah, we're ready to go forward. If you want our assistance, we'll try to help you.
Okay, just fill out the form.
Okay,
this thing goes a little bit further. Everything was taken out of my house. About 150, 165 people took everything off my lawn. It was supposed to put in storage, but they did not.
Well, you write everything up in your affidavit, exactly what happened, what your losses are, you know, and what exactly happened to you. And just in a storytelling fashion on an affidavit, you'll get all the instructions on the page, and then we'll see what we could do to help you.
Okay, there's one other part to it. When they took all the stuff out of my house, the wind was calm, and that night a norther blew in. And I had some properties. It was sand and gravel, oil and gas on a little over 200,000 acres. There was never a loan on it. And all that paperwork blew away. And I filed bankruptcy a couple of years prior to that. I put in that in bankruptcy, even though I didn't have a lien on it, but I showed it. And the value was $101,750,000. Well, it's over $100 million. And all this stuff blew away. So what do I do about that?
Well, again, you know, you need to write up your affidavit, and, you know, you need to be restored back to your original state if they did a nonjudicial foreclosure. Nonjudicial foreclosures lacks due process. And if they want to foreclose on you, they need to do it in a lawful manner. And the problem with them is that they can't do it. That's why they created this process. They've created their own problems, and that's their problem. So, you know, the best thing you could do is file the paperwork with us. We'll see what we can do. We're going to see how it goes. I mean, we're just starting this process. We have a lot of hope with it to show cause, so they got to answer. If they don't answer, they will default. I don't think they're going to get away with the claim of no standing. So I don't know what they're going to do, you know. There's no way they can prove anything. They got to start the whole process all over, and they got to do it properly. But meanwhile, they got to restore you now, don't they? No matter what they do.
Another problem is that 2 years prior to that, this was Bank of America. They assigned it to another company 2 years prior to that, so they never had standing. They didn't have nothing, and I paid for it four times.
Well, again, you know, write it up. That's the best I can tell you. Write up your affidavit. Go out to the site, follow the instructions, and write up the affidavit and get it all together.
Okay,
you'll find, again, you know, highlight on the blue line, go highlight the grand jury on the right side, and come down and click on non-judicial foreclosure. And on that page, you'll get the instructions.
Okay.
Now, right now on that page, we also ask for a copy of the non-judicial foreclosure paper. They would have served you with a paper, and on that paper should be a signature, and that signature would be the county, goodness, what would they call it? The county, not the tax collector, but the...
county clerk?
No. I don't know why I'm missing this in my mind at the moment. Well, it could be the comptroller. I don't think it would be, but it could be the comptroller.
Treasurer.
Thank you very much. In New York, you know, it was the treasurer in one county, but I just looked one up today, and it was called a commissioner, a finance commissioner in my county. So, but whoever's signature is on that paper down towards the bottom that's making the filing, because they have to have a signature to make the filing, you'll find a title. That's who we need to know to go after. That person, the tax collector within the town or the city or the village or whatever it is, and then the chief judge in that court. So, but the instructions is all there on our non-judicial foreclosure page.
I'm looking at it now, but there's a problem. See, this was supposed to be a remic put into the, well, you know what a remic is, don't you?
You're talking about INREM, I-N-R-E-M?
No, no, it's put in the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, but it was never transferred.
Well, then they securitized is what you're talking about.
Yes, it was never.
They securitized your property. That's a criminal action. We laid that out in the paperwork.
They owe $4.3 million because I made 84 payments and each one of them is $50,000, and all the money I paid is taxed at 100%. And they did not deny it. $4.3 million.
Hmm.
That's
well, again, issue. Write it up in your affidavit. Follow the instructions. We'll see what we can do for you.
Well, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Let's go to the next caller. Again, anybody wants to get into the queue, star 6. Got a couple of people in the queue right now, but star 6 if you want to get in the queue. 970, give us your first name and your state.
Hello, John. This is Ollie in Colorado.
Hey, how you doing, Ollie?
Hey, I talked to Lindsay. I talked to Lindsay a while ago. We're going out to Vegas the 12th, 13th, and the 14th. Now, that's going to be the critical weekend for that trial. Hope that it should be coming to a halt, you know, maybe a verdict. So if that trial is still going, I'll tell you what, that trial is all but come apart at the seams. However, most of the Portland people are coming down. Kelly's coming down. It's going to be a big meet-up. And if there's any NLA members in the area, I encourage them to come down to the courthouse in Vegas, you know, during that week. For about 12, 13th, and the 14th.
Make sure you get it out to Laurie at the courtroom observers and have them post it. We'll have Jan post something on the weekly updates.
Yeah. I'm going to take my video stuff out, so I'll hopefully get some good videos. But I'm anxious to go. All the people we met up in Missoula, Montana, they'll be there too, and it'll just be a sort of a homecoming of sorts. And it's just a joy to go out there and meet those people. It really is. And like I say, any NLA people in that area, come to Vegas. Come to Vegas.
All right. Okay. You know, again, just make sure you get the details to Lori and the details to Jan, and they'll get it out, to our membership. And you want to repeat it one more time, the details and how they would connect with you? You got a phone number or something, or what?
Okay, let me give you my cell number. It's 970-294-2974. Okay. Usually I don't use my cell phone on Skype, but on the road I'll be on my cell phone. But it's the 12th, 13th, and the 14th. And also on the 15th, we're going to go out to Pahrump, and I'd like to get in and see Almond and Ryan and Santilli and then maybe a couple others. It's a lot easier to get in there and see them. It's not like this crazy prison here in Colorado, but those are the details. Again, give me a call and we'll see what we can get going out there. Thanks, John.
Okay, thanks, Ollie. Okay, let's take our next caller, Fred from California. Go right ahead. You got the mic.
Hello there, John. Do I have any feedback?
How you doing? Nope, you're sounding good.
Okay, sir. I had a question for possibly you and Mr. Winters.
Okay.
That is the power of the notary as an officer of the court. I believe the notary has been watered down, and they have many constitutional powers that need to be addressed. And I will mute now.
Okay, Brent, maybe you could answer that better than I could.
Well, I can talk about it.
I don't have much knowledge about it, so go ahead.
Well, I can talk about it, and maybe I'll say something that would be of interest to him. I'm not an expert on the subject either, but I do know that notaries are, and their powers are ignored by and large. For example, you can go to the state of California. They take notaries pretty serious in the state of California, so much so that some people almost make a living. Come tax season, people line up to get their tax papers notarized, and they'll charge anywhere from $15 to $30 for a signature. And they're required to keep a special book and record everything they do. And recently out there, they've also passed a rule, says they've got to put an extra piece of paper, attach it to every piece of paper they notarize. Well, that's not true. Then in some Midwestern states, just the opposite. People will, that are notaries, anybody can become a notary. You don't have to take a course. You don't have to read a book. You don't have to prove you know anything. You just pay the fee and they send you the license and you can notarize documents. And in those states, it's not looked upon like it's much. But bottom line, what a notary is good for is taking an oath, swearing somebody. The oath is an important part of our legal tradition, has always been an important part, and it is now largely ignored. We were discussing the other day with some other lawyers and interested people, emails were going back and forth about people in court trying to, in IRS cases especially, and one of the lawyers had tried over 50 criminal cases in federal court, IRS cases. And I do know that in the earlier days, when he first began back in the early 80s, he routinely asked IRS agents on the witness stand if they could produce their oath. And they never could. And the courts won't make them do it. I've tried to seek the oath of federal judges. Well, this comes back to the notary. It comes back to the, because the notary isn't given much shrift these days because the oath has been ignored. People don't take it serious. Well, our Constitution of the United States takes it seriously and requires that every officer of not only federal but state governments take substantially the same oath. The reason that notaries aren't recognized with the power they have because of the lack of the attention to the oath. In the earlier times, the notaries were used when people had a hard time getting to the courthouse because it was too far and the roads weren't good enough. People just didn't travel that far. And if they needed documents sworn to, they could seek out a notary locally who could swear them to an affidavit. You see, an affidavit carried weight, too, that it doesn't carry now. The only place an affidavit really carries any weight today is trying to survive a motion for summary judgment. If you put in an affidavit that contradicts the facts of the other side, their motion for summary judgment, by law, won't survive. They won't get summary judgment. But it takes that affidavit. You got to get it in. Well, there it's important. But this whole thing that I've been taught and others have been taught doesn't stand true as a practical matter. This old thing that says if you swear to something in court and no one contradicts you by sworn statement, then that's evidence of the fact and that ends the matter. And I've seen people go to jail who swore to something and they brought in witnesses that swore to the same fact that exonerated them. The government didn't have anybody swear against it at all and they were still sent to jail. And that is because the oath doesn't have the force it used to for the reasons. The reasons are, of course, we are ignorant of the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God. The Bible uses the oath throughout. And just to throw in another interesting point about notaries, The Bible talks in the New Testament when Jesus Christ goes head to head with Babylonian Judaism and its proponents. That Babylonian religion called Judaism, the prototype of all false religions. He went head to head with them. And the two groups that are cited in the gospel records are the lawyers and the scribes, or the Pharisees and the scribes. Well, a lawyer is a civil law lawyer, a canon law lawyer, a lawyer of the law of the city. That's not a common law lawyer. That's different. Common law lawyers historically have been called commoners, and civil law lawyers have been called civilians. Civilians. Well, the translation of lawyers in the Bible there should be civilian, but the word scribe. And I have searched hard and long and contemplated the matter and tried to read up on what is a scribe. Well, fundamentally, he's a man that can read and write. I understand that. But more than that, a scribe is a notary in the New Testament, a notary public. And the office of notary public is a Roman civil law office. It's not, its roots are not in our common law. But it came to be a useful tool to us because we believed in the oath and we wanted people that could swear people to things. You know, you can swear an oath by yourself, but because people are ignorant of such things, because most folk, unfortunately, don't even know what an oath is. They'll swear to something, not really understanding what they're doing. That's been my experience. It all comes back to the oath. That's the way I see it. And we don't need to start with educating people on what is a notary and the powers of a notary, because that's a civil law office anyway. Those are the scribes of the New Testament. And they had great powers, by the way, and they knew a lot of things, a lot of the wrong things. They were educated in the law of the city in its Babylonian forms, and they understood it. But what we need more than notaries in America, this is my studied opinion, I don't know other people that take this position as strongly as I do. I know people that take this position, but maybe not as strongly. But because the oath is important to God, because he defines it so well in his express word, because he speaks often of the oath, because Paul the Apostle uses the oath in his writings throughout the New Testament, because Jesus Christ, contrary to the belief of the Quakers and other groups, did not do away with the oath when he said, do not swear, generally, the translations say do not swear at all. That's false. That's a false translation. It may not have been when it was translated. The meaning of the word all and at all is not what it was when the early translations were made. It should be translated, do not swear broadly. Do not swear wholly.
Yeah, I think the word conversations was in there too, if I recall. So in your conversations, you don't swear like that. That's what he's talking about.
Yeah, you don't just be loose about it. Just
right.
Flippantly, like swear.
Just yes and no. Let your conversations be yay and nay. Yeah.
But we've abandoned the God's point of view of the oath. And that's what I believe we should concentrate on more than the notary, if men would understand the oath. Because that's the glue that holds us together, and it is the final word. When you swear an oath, according to the book of Hebrews, the writer of the Hebrews is just observing. He said, an oath among men ends the matter. Well, that's the way it ought to be in court. If nobody can contradict the statement, then it should stand, and that should be the judgment should be made on that point. Well, thanks. That's all I have, John.
Yeah. Thanks, Brent. All right, Fred, anything else?
Yes, sir, I think. The Sanhedrin was the Jewish high council, and they were divided by two groups. I believe the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The Pharisees were scribes, and back in days of old, what the scribes would do is they would rewrite the Torah so that every synagogue would have a copy. And that's how they were able to quote it and knew it so well. They constantly rewrote it. Anyway, that was for Mr. Winters. My understanding of a Pharisee, like Paul was a Pharisee. But the Sadducees, they were the people that believed in angels, demons, miracles, visions, prophecy, and other things. They were like the Holy Rollers, within the Jewish community, so to speak. And that was the great division that Jesus, I mean, you saw it in Paul when Paul confronted the Sanhedrin. Anyway, I will mute out now.
Okay, appreciate it.
Appreciate it.
All right, well, we only got a couple of minutes. We have no more callers left. If someone has a question, you know, we could take another couple of minutes. Otherwise, we'll move towards our end. So we got another 3 or 4 minutes. Anybody else out there? *6, if you want to get into the queue. Okay, go right ahead. Helena, is that? 412? 412 phone number just came in. Oh, you're unmuted. Go right ahead.
Okay, John, it's Helena from Pennsylvania. I was wondering
how
you
doing?
You were reading from. I couldn't follow it, especially
on the memorandums?
The standing. I was interested in the prior document.
Right. Yeah, we didn't post that yet because we didn't have time to get it completed, and I can see as I read it that there's some more things we need to clean up on it. And but we should have that posted in the next couple of days, and it'll be posted up on the docket page, National Liberty Alliance. .org /docket. It'll be up there. It'll be under a memorandum. You can also get to it by just, clicking on highlighting grand jury and then clicking on docket. So you can get to it there too. So, but it'll be up there hopefully on in the next 2 days. And people can rewrite it for their own use concerning standing. Of course, you don't want to list out what we're doing because we're coming in as the grand jury. We wanted to make a strong point on our numbers. But, you know, one person has standing. Look at it. If you've been violated in any way by, you know, something, you have standing, period. You're
unbelievably crystal clear the way you explained it. It was like jaw-dropping. Thank you ever so much.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
What was the first document called?
Well, the other one was the law, to understand the difference between the law and statutes. So we do not have to abide by statutes. Statutes are for you know, the bureaucrat, for the elected individual, the appointed individual, the individual employed by the government. That's what statutes are for. It's not for the people. Statutes are also for certain activities, commercial activities, that we've given the authority of, which is called law. You know, we've given the legislators certain powers to write law. You can read about that in Article 1, Section 8. And there's like 17, there's 18 powers, I believe it is, that have been given to Congress. The 18th power is the ability to write law on the first 17 powers. So that's where they have the authority to write law. So other than that, they don't have the right to, or the authority to write law to control our behavior or require us to get licenses or permits or any kind of permission from them to exercise one of our unalienable rights. So that's basically what that other paper was about, to explain what statutes are and regulations and code versus the law of the land, which is the Constitution, and the common law, which is also part of the law of the land, of course, which is what we have decided to be judged by when we have to go into a court for any reason. We're to be judged by common law if there's a criminal, you know, account put upon us.
Okay, for that gentleman who said that he thought that maybe there was a stingray who knew his whereabouts, I've been doing an awful lot of research, and I might be able to help him understand how they target lock and target track a person. And it's not with a stingray. It's a motion sensor with radar that target locks and target tracks, and it's called a radio locator. I've done an awful lot of Freedom of Information requests, and I've actually gotten some responses about it. I've talked to Terry about it and to Jan about it. So if the gentleman wants more information on it, he can give me a call if he wants to.
Okay, I don't know if you want to give your number or have him get a hold of Jan to get in touch with you, or what do you want to do?
I don't mind giving out my number. It's 412.
Yeah, give out your number. If they're still here, they can get your number.
412-782-441. If you go to like deep dive website, dive is spelled D-Y-V-E, deep dive, and look up radio locators, you can find a lot of stuff on there. And it's with radio frequency that they locate people.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Helena.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call. Okay, we're going to end our program. It's now a couple of minutes before the hour. So thanks, everyone, for coming. Lord willing, we'll see you next Monday. And so everybody should continue to participate, become educated, take advantage of our courses, read our papers, read the book we put together on the common law. And, you know, and if you can, everybody should be able to help us out with $5 a month or more. Okay, good night. Thank you very much. No warning as I goodbye.
Peace.